So exciting.
Me too. Wow, well, I get the short seat.
Oh, also, where are we doing this?
All my cards.
Nice to be seen.
My goal is to leave somewhere.
I hope so.
Okay. The House Interim Committee on Revenue for December 7th, 2016 will come to order. December 7th is when we posted. December 12th is today.
The day that you're living in.
Is today, right. All right. We'll come to order, and we're going to open a work session on a committee bill introduction. Now, I understand that Representative Davis has an issue he'd like to raise, and then and we may hear from Led's counsel.
Thank you, Chair. I understand the next order of business is introducing bills.
Correct.
Here in our interim committee.
And we're in work session for that purpose.
That will be committee bills for the 79th Legislative Assembly starting in January. My question that I have for Legislative Council, if Mr. Johnson is here,
he's here.
I am an outgoing member of the 78th Legislative Assembly, will not be voting or taking action on bills in the 79th Legislative Assembly. I'm questioning the appropriateness of me voting on an introduction for a later legislative assembly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council, and there's both a straightforward answer and a constitutional answer to your question. The straightforward, simple one is that the House rules that you all adopted at the beginning of the 2015 session permit pre-session filing of committee bills, as is going on here. So those are the rules that are in effect. It allows you to do that. The constitutional component of that is there's a principle that one legislature can't bind the hands of a future legislature. And first of all, the Constitution doesn't actually say that. It's more of a practical notion that one legislature may enact something, but a subsequent legislature can just go ahead and do what it chooses to do. But in this context, the significant thing is that legislatures act by taking floor votes under the constitutional scheme enacted. That the Constitution doesn't even envision committees, for example. From the constitutional perspective, what happens is that each chamber, by majority or supermajority vote, votes on something. That's how they act. And so by simply having a committee introduce a bill for pre-session filing, you're not actually binding in any sense a future legislature, the 79th legislature, because all that will happen is that the bill will be introduced, first read, and assigned by the presiding officer to a committee. That's all that will happen. It's a long way from being a bill or being enacted, and that's what, from the constitutional sense, is what's significant.
Follow up?
Mm-hmm. Please.
Thank you very much. A broader question I have is, it seems to me that introducing bills in December of 2016 for a legislative session that the public understands is going to begin in 2017 looks an awful lot like, from the public's view, having sessions start in December of 2016 with a member of that body who's not going to be a member of the next session. So I guess the undercurrent of that question is, what are we actually doing here in introducing bills? I mean, I understand an interim committee having informational hearings on issues. I get very uncomfortable in taking action that looks like it's part of a session that continues unabated through January, February, and through 2017.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, as I mentioned, what you're doing is just taking the first step in triggering this process of a bill being introduced, first read, assigned to committee in the 2017 session, and so on. And the 18 legislature in organizational session, when it considers rules, it can have the power to provide by rule otherwise. It can say in each chamber can say we will not consider bills that are pre-session filed. They have that power. There's one exception to that, that it would require a legislative change with respect to agencies, both executive branch and judicial branch agencies, pre-session file pursuant to statute. And that would have to, there'd have to be a statutory change to prohibit that. But with respect to pre-session filing of committee bills, it would be the 2017 legislature would have the power to provide by rule that that can't happen. But that's the rules that are in effect now don't say that.
I think that's all I have.
Thank you. Representative Vance, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just looking at Section 10 of the Constitution, and it reads, Section 10, annual regular sessions of the Legislative Assembly, organizational session, And then it goes on to say how many days we can be in business. And it says, sub 2, the Legislative Assembly may hold an organizational session that is not subject to limits of subsection 1 for the purpose of introducing measures and performing duties. So I guess I need to have you define for me, if you could, and all of us, what that phrase organizational session means, because the chair and I were debating that a few minutes ago when this issue came up. So what is an organizational session?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, well, it is, I don't have the Constitution in front of me, but it is essentially one of, you do three things. You credential members. You adopt You adopt rules, you appoint officers, and pursuant to the language you just read, you introduce, which means first read, bills that are then subsequently assigned by the presiding officer to whatever committee is appropriate.
And the follow-up.
Please, yeah.
And, of course, that brings us right to this point. What are we doing today? Does that make what we're doing today an organizational session?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, no. The Constitution, again, doesn't really recognize the committee system, doesn't reference committees. It sets forth a procedure for introducing bills that requires a first reading, and that's what happens in organizational session. You are setting the stage for that, but the first reading of those occurs during organizational session.
Right. Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Right. Well, the obvious, why did whoever drafted this constitutional section provide for a, quote, organizational session, end quote? Because what you're saying, I'm thinking, is that we would have to fire up the session on February 1st, whatever day it is. That doesn't seem right. This seems to anticipate that we would have a session prior to those days. That's what I read this to mean, that we would have something in addition to the 160 calendar days. And if that's the case, then why isn't this part of that organizational session?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, the reason this isn't is because your terms have ended, will have ended by January 7th or whatever the day that you get sworn in. That's when your current legislative terms end. So the organizational session begins on the day that you are sworn in.
Mm-hmm.
Please, yeah.
Okay, I guess what I'm worried about is, are we, when we introduce these bills today, if we do, if the conclusion, at the conclusion of this, within this work session, we vote to introduce these bills, we're not in any way creating a constitutional flaw in these bills, are we? That would give someone an opportunity to set it aside later because it was inappropriately introduced in whatever it is we're engaged in today?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, no, you're not. As I mentioned, the Constitution does not even envision a committee system. And so what the Constitution requires, and the only thing the Constitution requires, is that bills be enacted by majority or applicable supermajority vote in each chamber, and that the ones that are enacted read identically.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I recall that it's been the custom for a long time, and probably as a result of rules, from the whole time I've been in the legislature since 2001, that outgoing members often introduced bills. Not introduced, that's the wrong word. Had bills prepared for introduction before their terms ended for the next session, and actually sponsored bills that that were first read early in session, even before this constitutional amendment went into effect. And that's still the rule, isn't it? That an outgoing member who is leaving, who's not going to be in the next session, can still prepare and propose bills for first reading on organizational day, can't they?
Mr. Chair, I believe that, first of all, we're not talking about committees, we're talking about individual members, right. Yes, I believe that one chamber permits that and the other chamber does not, and it's a function of rule again.
And it's based on the fact that there's a rule that says so one way or the other.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's correct. All of this is can be changed by the incoming Legislative Assembly changing rules to provide something different.
So what we're doing today is related to the rules of the House. And what happens on organizational day is the introduction of bills through first readings.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Helm, please.
Mr. Chair, and Dexter, I had the benefit of this conversation in our previous committee meeting for the Land Use and Rural Communities and Water Committee that was held just prior to this. And Representative Gomberg asked you a question about whether the same, your answer would be the same as to individual member pre-session filing of bills as it would be to committee bills.
Mr. Chair, Representative Helm, that's correct. And the answer was that it is the same. It's a function of what the rules provide. And currently, with respect to individuals, I believe one chamber, I could be mistaken about this, I did not, it was all off the top of my head, but I believe one chamber allows it and the other chamber does not allow it.
Yeah. Any other questions for our legislative council? Representative Smith-Warner, you have a motion.
I do, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move that the committee introduce the following LC drafts for introduction to the 79th.
As committee bills.
As committee bills. Thank you. LC 954, LC 1040, LC 1049, LC 1697, LC 2257, LC 2286, LC 2365, LC 2369, LC 2372, LC 2375, LC 2381, LC 2382, LC 2383, LC 2384, LC 2387, LC 2389, LC 2391, LC 2395, LC 2397, LC 2399, LC 2402, LC 2404, LC 2464, LC 2483, LC 2527, LC 2528, LC 2529, LC 2530, LC 2532, LC 2533, LC 2534, LC 2535, LC 2536, LC 2537, LC 2538, LC 2539, LC 2540, LC 2541, LC 2577, LC 2587, LC 2743, LC 2767, and LC 2914.
Thank you. Representative Smith-Warner moves that the committee introduce as committee bills LC 954, LC 1040, LC 1049, LC 1697, LC 2257, LC 2286, LC-2365, LC-2369, LC-2372, LC-2375, LC-2381, LC-2382, LC-2383, LC-2384, LC-2387, LC-2389, LC-2391, LC-2395, LC-2397, LC-2399, LC-2402, LC-2404, LC-2464, LC-2483, LC-2527, LC-2528, LC-2529, LC-2530, LC-2532, LC-2533, LC-2534, LC-2535, LC-2536, LC-2537, LC-2538, LC-2539, LC-2540, LC-2541, LC-2577, LC-2587, LC-2743, LC-2767, and LC-2914. And that's the motion, and it's open for discussion. Let me say before discussion that the committee's vote to introduce these bills as committee bills does not imply that anyone on the committee supports any of these bills or opposes any of these bills or, in fact, has any position on any of these bills. It simply is a way for the legislature to get bills before it on opening day for first reading, which then allows the speaker to assign bills to committee, and so that we are prepared to go to work on our first day in session on February 1st. Any other discussion? Representative Davis, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Legislative Counselor, Council, Mr. Johnson, for speaking. I've always enjoyed, as part of this committee, the intersection of policy and constitutional law that we've discussed, and today was another interesting discussion. As my last act, maybe, as a legislator, I will attempt to refrain from acting. I've been told that I can't abstain from a vote, so I'll have to vote no on introducing these bills. It's my belief that there's the constitutional argument, which I think is an open question. I think Dexter Johnson did a very nice job laying out what that argument is, but as Representative Benson and I discussed, there's another side to that. And then I think there's the public argument of, to me, this seems an awful lot like organizational days. And I am a legislator who was elected for the 78th Legislative Assembly, not for the next legislative assembly. I don't think it comports with the public understanding of next legislative assembly to have me take any action on the bills that will be introduced. So for those reasons, I'll be voting no.
Thank you. Other discussion? Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as much as I'd like to join my soon much-to-be-missed colleague, Representative Davis, in this, I'll be voting for the bills. And that has primarily to do with the fact that we have rules that address the issue. I think the argument is well taken, though, and I plan on raising it when we look at our rules for the next session. There's other reasons that committee bills are challenging, is the lack of fingerprints, for example, and other things like that that probably need to be addressed. But, I'll be voting in favor of that motion.
Another additional? Yes, Representative Johnson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would just mention, you know, that on my calendar, I think it's January the 9th is swearing-in day followed by organizational days. So it does seem a little redundant to be looking at this as organizational days, and then we come back for meet again in session for January 10th, 11th, whatever, for organizational days again. And I agree with my colleagues that I think we need to clearly look at the rules that we adopt for this next session, because this just doesn't seem to make sense. And it seems to me like we have established a precedent that doesn't really have any value. And so I really would ask all of us who will be here in the next session to clearly look this over. And I mean, where would we draw the limits? Could we not have done this in September when we were here?
Mm-hmm.
Could we have done this in May when we were here as an interim committee? I suppose we could have if we chose to, but would that have been worthwhile and germane and helpful to the process for the next session? I would argue not to, but not, but anyway.
Representative Helm?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll repeat what I said in my former committee hearing, and that's the reason I asked Mr. Johnson the question I did. His answer essentially states that it doesn't make any difference whether it's the committee introducing these bills for pre-session filing or individuals. So I could, with the permission of whoever had these bills drafted, trot them over to the clerk and ask them to be introduced, and they would have the same status as they're going to have if we pass them here. So I appreciate the caution, but I just don't see a clear distinction at this time that would cause us to not move ahead.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I would, yes, I'm sorry, Representative Whitsitt, please.
I also will be voting no because I can't vote to abstain from this for the same reason as Representative Davis.
And
I won't be here.
And we will, we will miss both of you and your wise counsel in the next session.
Thank you.
And may you have great luck and great fortune in your future endeavors. Thank you. I would, just to conclude this, or hopefully conclude this conversation, other people may want to break in after I've had my say. When I first came here, sessions were very slow to get underway. Part of that was because bill introduction took place on the first day. Then they had to be referred to committee, and then they had to be committee chairs had to figure out what their agenda was going to be, and then sort of things got going after the session had been underway for a couple of weeks. The result of that was that in 2003 and 2005, we had extremely long sessions. Sessions ended at the end of August, or middle of August, or the end of August, and they went on much longer than was necessary, in my view. But part of it was because of the very relaxed way in which we started. All this rule does, and the rule that allows individual members to introduce bills or to cause bills to be introduced on organizational days at this point, is allow us to hit the ground running on February 1st. The speaker will have bills that we have first read. Whoever the speaker is will have bills that's been first read on the organizational day. The speaker will then have a chance to look at those bills to determine what committees they should be referred to, and refer them to the committees. The committee chair will have a week before we ever meet to decide what bills should be heard first and how the committee operation should go. And so the committee, including this one, will have real work done on the first day. And that means it's possible then to meet the constitutional closure date sometime in early July, rather than having the thing go on much later. I think that's the reason why the House rule exists the way it does now, and I think it's a good rule. And unless there's some other debate, we'll vote.
Representative Whitsitt. Question. The procedure that we just went through, where Representative Smith-Warner read the numbers and then you read the numbers, did that have to be a duplicate of each number or one introduction of each? Because you left out reading LC 2385, and she left out reading LC 2393, just in case something comes up where you had to have introduced them both by reading them today. You each left off a different LC.
Well, it was the intention of both of us to read all of the ones that are on the list.
I know. I just want to let you know.
And 2393 is not on the list. And so you may have meant a different one.
Oh, I don't know. It's on my list.
You have an old list.
Oh, okay. That's why.
We revised the list.
You read the, yeah.
Okay. Okay. So
2385.
Right. The correct list, and for those who want...
The list I was reading...
The correct list is to be found in OLIS, And it is, the list itself is the first item under meeting materials. And that is the, and it's called document 94601. And that is the one that both Representative Smith Warner made the motion on, and which, and the list from which I repeated the motion. Just so it's very clear to everyone what we're voting on. And I think with that, I'll ask for a roll call, since we've had some who indicate they plan to vote no.
Representative Davis.
No.
Representative Helm.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Leininger.
Aye.
Representative Nels.
Aye.
Representative Whitsett.
No.
Vice Chair Benz.
Aye.
Mr. Smith Warner.
Aye.
And Chair Barnhart.
Aye. The motion, having received the required majority, is passed, and the motion will now go to the clerk for further action. All right, thanks. And with that, we'll close. Any other business under the work session?
No, I'm done. Sure, that's okay. It.
We'll close the work session on. On bill committee bill introduction and open the informal informational meeting, and it is now 2:15, as the clock clearly shows, for tax expenditure report.
Sorry, Chair. That was my fault.
Thank you, gentlemen. Paul, do you want to introduce?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is kind of our biennial exercise. When the governor releases her budget, as she did a couple weeks ago, the tax expenditure report also comes out with that, the accompanying tax expenditure report that you're all familiar with. And that's been put together since 1995 by the Department of Revenue. So we've invited the Department of Revenue research staff to come over and go through the updated report with you, talk about some of the changes, and talk about the highlights of their findings.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. excuse me. My name is Tim Fitzgerald. I'm an economist with the Department of Revenue Research Section. I'm here with John Hart, a senior economist with the Department of Revenue Research Section, and we're talking about the tax expenditure report. As indicated, it's a biennial report that gets updated as part of the budget process. And we're just going to try to present some information in general about it. I hope a lot of you are already familiar with it. And then John's going to talk a bit more about some of the issues with it this year and some issues in general. My slides are slightly out of order, so I'm going to skip and come back. A tax expenditure is defined in law, and it's, I'm not going to read the whole definition, but the important part of it in a lot of ways is that it exempts something from the impact of established taxes. And so what we tend to take that to mean is that an established tax essentially consists of a base, which is what's going to be taxed, and a rate or a rate structure that's going to be applied to that base. And so any kind of deviation from that, and then this sort of lists off, you know, exclusions or credits or anything else like that, those are what we tend to look for tax expenditures. And there's a lot that goes into that, and it's not always a clear-cut process, and it's one of the things that John's going to talk about a bit more. So as part of the law, we're required to provide a lot of information about each individual tax expenditure. There's over 360 of them this year, which means you could read one a day for an entire year and not get through the entire book. So we have to provide the statutory authority for each one, the purpose behind each one. Sometimes that's written into statute. Sometimes that has to be inferred from what the law seems to be trying to do. We try to estimate the lost tax revenue that's associated with it. Now, this isn't the same as a revenue estimate for if the law were repealed. That's something that has to be generated a little bit separately. But it's an estimate of the lost tax revenue for the current biennium and the next biennium and the effects that it has. We're also to look at who benefits from the tax expenditure. So we try to look at, for example, if it's a property tax one, which counties are we seeing the property tax exemption being used in? If it's income tax, we tend to look at the breakdown of the income structures, the higher income people, lower income people, non-filers, residents, that kind of thing. For the evaluation, we tend to farm this out to a lot of state agencies. We work with dozens of state agencies who have some expertise in the specific areas. So if it's a housing issue, we might talk to housing. If it's energy, we might talk to energy. And they what they do is they take a look at what's being done on this, and they try to provide an evaluation of whether it's succeeding at its purpose. Is it actually accomplishing what it's set out to do? In some cases, this could be fairly straightforward. Yes, you know, providing more housing or not, that kind of thing. But it can be pretty difficult. And it's a lot of work from those agencies, and they really helped us out this year in getting a lot of, providing a lot of feedback on that. The law also requires us to categorize these. We categorize them by budget function or program. So, for example, like education-related ones or whatnot. We have a few things that aren't exactly budget categories. That's how we categorize them, because when you get to tax expenditures, it's not always the same as spending. So, for example, the fact that we can't tax federal property isn't really a spending in the normal sense that you might think of the term, but we need a category for the various related ones that come up under that. Lastly, the governor, as part of the book, is required to provide recommendations for whether to extend or allow to sunset any of the provisions that are going to be up for renewal during the 17-19 session. I believe there were 16 of them this time, and that's in the report, as well as, I believe, in the governor's budget. So the contents of the report. This year there are 16 chapters. It's one more than the previous book. That's because there's a marijuana retail tax. And because of that, there's an exemption for the medical marijuana. And because that's been exempted from the tax, it creates a new tax expenditure. We have a whole new chapter to cover that. There's one chapter for each tax program, but we combine income and corporate taxes because they're so often related. There's so many credits that you can take both as a corporation and as an individual, or that there's a subtraction and whatnot. So it's easier for organizational purposes to kind of combine them all together. Income tax programs make up 190 out of the 367 in the book, and so it's the vast majority of it, and that is where a lot of the work goes in. Property tax makes up another 137, so out of all 367, the vast majority are it's income tax, and then a lot in property, and then a little bit elsewhere. The report also has a lot of tables and appendices, and I just want to kind of point out that a lot of the information we have, we put everything we can into the book, but there's always a tension between being complete and being concise. And we have a lot more information that's not necessarily here, and I always want to make it available. We have some stuff that's on our website, and if you want additional information about these, we have a lot that we can provide. And so we always kind of invite, you know, if you have questions, if you're looking for information, we love working with LRO on that stuff. And then just to kind of sum that up, the tax expenditure report is a very good place to start looking at these. You know, there are, as I said, 367 is a huge number. And if you want to start trying to look at these details, it's not easy to get a grip on the whole tax system. And so this report is a good way to get a starting place on some of these measures and to get an idea of what's going on. And with the revenue estimates, to give you an idea of how big are these, how much of an impact do they have. And so thinking of that, we provide this table to summarize a little bit of the quantities we're talking about here. So we compare the estimated revenues for these tax programs with the total revenue impact that we have estimated for the coming biennium. And you can see that they're fairly substantial. You're talking over $13.4 billion in estimated revenue loss from the income tax-related expenditures and over $10 billion on the property tax ones. Now, this for those of you who have looked at this before, this is actually pretty substantially different from last year's summary table like that, and that's because we removed a single entry from the book that was taking up about 40% of the total revenue impact, and that was intangible personal property as a property tax exemption. Essentially, we took another look at the way that the law is written in terms of how you define a tax expenditure. For a lot of reasons, we did a more in-depth analysis this year. And when we did that, intangible personal property has been an ongoing debate for years about whether it's a real exemption or not. And this year, we finally decided it really isn't. It doesn't meet the criteria from the way that we look at it. And so we removed it from the report.
Mr. Chair?
Excuse me. Representative Nose?
So for the non-lawyer, there's a few of us. Can you remind me what intangible property is?
Absolutely. So the way the property tax system is defined, they say real property and tangible personal property is what is going to be taxed.
Okay.
And so what you can think of.
Actual object.
So, yeah. So land, buildings on the land, and then also all anything physical, even computers and whatnot, sure. Are tangible personal property. So intangible personal property would represent everything like bank accounts, patents. For businesses, it can represent goodwill or for basically the total value when you add in everything that's not a physical asset.
Yes, please.
So hang with me here for just a minute. So I understand a patent or a logo or brand how does goodwill get measured as an intangible? That makes no sense to me at all.
So the reason, to get into this a little bit, so intangible personal property is generally not taxed, but it is taxed for companies that have a method of central assessment, which is one of the reasons why we used to consider this to be an exemption, because the law basically says, except for the purposes of central assessment of companies, intangible personal property is not included. But since the definition in the line before it doesn't include intangible property, therefore it's not an exemption. It was never part of it to begin with. And I don't want to get into there's several ongoing litigations in regards to that specific issue.
Okay.
So again, this is about the definition of tax expenditure. And like I said, it's a base times a rate. And since intangible property is not generally part of the base, it's not an exemption that it's not included.
Fair enough.
And again, so when you're talking about a company, you're talking like the book value of a company, which includes all value. And that's why it includes intangibles.
Okay.
Representative Pence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So your thought is, or approach is, that since it's not part of the base, it's not something that we could tax but chose not to.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, it's not so much it's a question of how you define the base. And if the legislature defines the base in a different way, then they can choose to do that. But whatever they define the base to be, that's then what we compare for the purposes of the question of established tax. So it's not any kind of limitation on the action there. It's just how it's currently defined.
Oh, is there some other large area other than intangibles that we've chosen not to tax? Just you can give us some kind of parallel things that we just, there's certain things that we just haven't taxed.
Well, for example, sales is the most common one that tends to come up. There's no retail sales tax in Oregon generally, and so that would be, some person might consider the fact that we don't tax that to be a tax expenditure. We don't think it meets the criteria as been set by law.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah,
with that.
Thank you.
That's right.
So Appendix D of our report lists some of the changes that have happened from previous reports. So the new ones that have been added because of legislation, primarily in 2015 and 2016 sessions, and the ones that have been modified by the legislature, there were 28 existing laws that were modified, or 28 tax expenditures that were modified. And in addition, a large number were taken out. Only a few were taken out because they actually expired and no longer have an impact. The rest were removed for various reasons, some of them because of sort of technical reasons and some like intangible. There was a bit of a debate about whether it qualified to begin with.
Can you go back to your previous one before that? Right there. And can you explain, define for the, or elaborate on the federal exclusion line item? What is that exactly?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm John Hart, an economist in the research section at the Oregon Department of Revenue. I have the honor of being, I don't know if responsible is the right word, but producing the description for the 102 federal provisions. The federal exclusions are income that people have that is not subject to tax, and generally it is not listed on a tax return anywhere. And so that one example of that is for non-agricultural small businesses, we allow cash accounting as the basis of determining income, and we believe that cash accounting in those cases defers income from taxation, and so that deferred income is not listed on a tax return.
Well, so in looking at federal exclusions, why is the word federal there?
Because we have a tie to the federal definition of taxable income. So our starting place for Oregon taxable income is, roughly speaking, federal taxable income. And so if it's excluded at the federal level, that exclusion flows through to the Oregon level. And so that exclusion becomes excluded income on the Oregon return as someone starts to fill out their form.
And that's by our choice. It's not somehow immune by virtue of federal law. It's immune by virtue of federal choice, and we have chosen to link up and follow it.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Benz, yes, we have a choice on those. Some of those would be extremely difficult or impossible to tax. The cash accounting, for instance, if we wanted to tax that, we would have to require businesses to account for their income in a different way than they account for it on their federal form. And it would be a burden to the taxpayer.
and follow up, thank you, Michelle. We give these numbers a lot of weight. I mean, there's a big number there, $5-6 billion, but you're telling us that it would be almost impossible to collect it. But we tend to see these numbers tossed about as something we could have if we just wanted to exercise the will to get it, but you're suggesting otherwise.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, we follow the definition in statute of what a tax expenditure is, and some of these would be impossible to get, some of them would not. We don't get reporting on some of this some of these. I think the largest of the federal exclusions is the exclusion of taxation on health care provided by employers, and that itself is, I think, over $1 billion. That's something we don't get information about, but with some administrative changes, we could ask to have that taxed if that was a policy choice. But as far as what's included in the book, we're following the statute that requires us to take any law of the federal government that exempts income from the established tax.
Thank you.
So speaking of the large ones, we like to provide a list of the top 10 tax expenditures for personal and corporate taxes. As was mentioned, of these 10, 7 of them are actually due to Oregon's connection to federal law. The 3 highlighted ones in blue are ones that are specific to Oregon law. And combined, these top 10 out of the 190 represent 69% of the total revenue impact that we estimate for 17-19. So it's a, you know, it's a very unequal distribution. There's a lot of very small ones, and there's a few very, very large ones in terms of this mix. For property tax, it's the same basic story, just even more extreme. The top 10 property tax exemptions represent 91% of the total estimated revenue loss for the 17-19 biennium. And if you look at the list, you can see these are ones, again, that would be a little tricky to talk about taxing. State and local property, federal property, and personal property for personal use are all ones I've never seen necessarily questions about taxing. So.
So we've presented the tax expenditure report to this committee more than once now in this biennium, so we thought this would be an opportunity to add some of the behind-the-scenes look at how we do some of the work, and to present some of the changes that we've made to make our work more transparent. And the first topic there is the view of federal provisions generally. Our tie to federal taxable income means that we are tied to federal exclusions, federal deductions, and above-the-line federal deductions that we call federal adjustments. And those things come to us through acts of Congress or through the inaction of Congress. This has become more difficult in the last 15 years as there have been budgetary restrictions or rules in Congress that have made making some of these things permanent more difficult for Congress. And so we have a recurrence of what's called tax extenders. Until recently, one of those tax extenders, for instance, was the deduction for teachers purchasing supplies for their classroom. That tended to be renewed about every 2 years, and we never knew whether that was going to be renewed or not. And so we would be kind of reporting some things without as much information as we could, and we weren't as good at reporting our source for that information as we could be. So we've tried to become more transparent and rely exclusively on the Federal Joint Committee on Taxation to define what is a tax expenditure at the federal level, and to use their reporting more extensively and more fully. Things like the exclusions that include a lot of the accounting treatments, we lack data on, so we rely on the Federal Joint Committee to make a national estimate from which we then derive a state estimate. We do have, for our Oregon provisions and for itemized deductions and adjustments, we generally have data from our tax returns, so we do have data on those, and we make good estimates with that data as well. But JCT also doesn't give a full estimate on a lot of provisions that they believe are either too small, they've quantified it and it's less than $50 million a year at the federal level, or things that they can't quantify. So we have started to make kind of a better mapping of those federal provisions to our Oregon report. And part of that is we now list the provisions that JCT doesn't estimate because they're too small or unquantifiable. And we list provisions that Oregon specifically disconnects from. And if we're combining provisions that the JCT is reporting separately, we note that in our descriptions. So on pages 104 and 105 of our report, we have 16 items that the JCT reports they are tax expenditures, they can be quantified, but they're too small to quantify, so we just list those out. We have 24 that they report as not quantifiable, and we list those out. And those tend to be very small, and they tend to actually be specific to other geographical regions. And we have 8 federal provisions that Oregon has specifically disconnected from federal law, such as what's called the QPI, or a qualified production activities income deduction. We specifically add that back to Oregon income to tax. So those provisions are listed. And as an example of where we've combined some federal provisions, we have there our second tax expenditure in the book, qualified education savings, where we've combined prepaid tuition programs, savings account programs, and exclusion of earnings of trust accounts for higher education. The first two are commonly known as 529 accounts. Also, because as we've heard, there's some difficulty in actually coming to a very clear definition on what a tax expenditure is, we have created some criteria to help us identify a tax expenditure. As an example of a tax expenditure that fits our statutory definition but other people might not see as a tax expenditure, we have an exemption from the lodging tax for hospital stays. The lodging tax was designed for tourism and travel related lodging, but there is in statute a specific exemption for hospital stays and several other things. So the question of what is the established tax, you might come down on the established tax is to tax tourism and travel-related lodging. But because we have a statutory exemption for those hospital stays, we list those as a tax expenditure and make an estimate. I think we make an estimate. Oh, okay. That one is an unknowable number that we have not made an estimate for. partly because it probably wasn't intended to be part of the tax base. It just has a specific exemption. So our criteria for what is a tax expenditure begins with it reduces taxes and not fees owed. Also, we don't count anything that reduces penalty or interest, like penalty waivers or the amnesty that we had in 2009. We did not call a tax expenditure because it didn't reduce tax. Tax expenditure also is something reported by the Federal Joint Committee on Taxation as a reduction in taxable income that flows through to Oregon. We will take all of those as they define them, or if we have a specific reduction of income taxable by Oregon or a credit to Oregon tax, we call that a tax expenditure. The mathematical features of the tax, filing statuses and tax brackets, we don't call those tax expenditures. And if a business subtracts their ordinary and necessary business costs, we don't call that subtraction a tax expenditure. There are some credits and some deductions that are necessary to avoid double taxation of the same income, such as the credit for taxes paid to another state, income taxes paid to another state. We don't call that a tax expenditure. And there's at least one program, the Oregon Greenlight Labor Rebate, that refunds taxes paid by one taxpayer to a different taxpayer. But since that's not reflected on a tax return or tax statement and it occurs after the tax is actually paid, we don't call that one a tax expenditure. And on the on the same theme as not of the kind of vagueness in the definition of the term tax expenditure. We have seen some attempts recently to use the definition of tax expenditure in ways that assume that it's more authoritative than it is. In 2012, for instance, there was an initiative petition that would have required tax expenditures, the amount, be limited to the amount of the general fund. And that raises the stakes significantly on using this definition. When the definition is used for reporting, the stakes are it's in the book or it's not in the book. When the definition is used for something else like that, or like the recent law that has added a implicit sunset on anything enacted by the legislature as 6 years after the date it's first in place, those things have real effects on individual taxpayers and on the administration of the tax system. And so those limits can be hard or impossible to implement if something's prohibited from taxation by federal law, or if something is difficult to quantify, like the difference in cash accounting versus accrual accounting. Those would be challenges at best if there's sunset placed on those, or if they're limited by some percentage, for instance. And that's the end of our prepared remarks. I'm happy to take more questions.
Well, thank you so much. Are there questions? You prepared a very fat book. We are working our way through it slowly. Everyone has one, yes? And be prepared for further questions later.
Of course.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And with that, we are ready to hear from the governor's office on revenue proposals. Ms. Porter. Mr. Porter, thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you for having me. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Vince Porter. I'm the governor's policy advisor on jobs and economy. I brought both of the fat books with me just if we need to reference any of them. But just wanted to come and give a few insights on the governor's budget and some of the proposals that were put forth in the budget and also relating to some of the tax expenditures. It's safe to say, as the governor said last week, this is the beginning of a conversation that I'm sure you all will have with us and the governor about the pathway forward on the budget in 17-19 session. And with that, I think the context of the revenue proposals that were put forward in the governor's budget were largely thought of as short-term fixes that are, again, part of a conversation, but also in light of the large cuts that would be due if you provided no revenue. Quite frankly, the governor was not prepared to put forward a budget of that drastic measure. So I just wanted to walk through a few of them, and I apologize for not bringing written materials, but as I said, we can go through these if we want. In the governor's proposals, to the tax expenditures, recommend $183 million of tax expenditures to go away. There are two that make up that amount. The partnership pass-through tax expenditure, which I believe, and Dr. Warner, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that the full biennium expenditure amount of that would be $230 million if you did it from the calendar year of 2017. The governor's proposal would be that you would return to the original rate in January 1 of 2018, which would save $177 million. Also, as of January 1 of 2018, removing the tax expenditure for the IC DISC companies that take advantage of that. As far as new taxes, The main ones I'm here to talk about are the proposals in the tobacco taxes and the liquor taxes. Relating to tobacco, a total of $35.2 million of taxes are being proposed. A few of them, for example, the governor's proposing that we would up the cigarette tax by 75 cents, which would account for $21 million of that amount, and increasing other tobacco taxes to a total of 13.7 You'd increase the cigar tax by 50 cents, snuff by 89 cents an ounce, and all other products from 65% of wholesale to 75% of wholesale. And then finally on the taxes, there were two liquor taxes that were proposed. One would be to increase the distilled spirits from 50 cents a bottle to $1 a bottle. That along with an increase of alcohol licensing fees would amount to a total of $39.1 million. It's my understanding that the increased distilled spirits tax would actually be a vote by the OLCC, and that any of the proposed fees, alcohol licensing fees, would be a statutory requirement. Then finally, on the expiring tax credits, traditionally, to be honest, we have tended to just renew all of them for the conversation for the legislature to look at. In this case, we decided not to do that, and partly for policy reasons, but also largely for budget reasons. So the governor did not renew approximately $28 million of the expiring tax expenditures. I think there were about $6 or $7 million that were recommended for renewal. And I'd be happy to answer any more detailed questions on any of these.
Great. Questions? Representative Bentz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Vince, thank you for the presentation. Your initial remarks concerned the pass-through tax credit and the ICDS. Those are both part of the so-called grand bargain. I guess my question would be, as we look into next year and we anticipate negotiating, what do we take this to be? An illustration of how long these deals are going to be kept? I mean, what's the lesson that we're to take from this suggestion? Now, let me say a couple of things to kind of head off what I think you might be saying. I think one of the justifications for the change in the pass-through was that it wasn't working well enough. And yet we've only had it for 1 year. The idea was that it would create income investment. And so I would challenge any assertion that there's been a track record generated to suggest that this is not working, because we haven't had it long enough. That'd be my observation. The ICDS thing, that's an interesting thing. It has to do with exports. Complicated. It was part of the grand bargain, though. So what I'm really asking is, what assurance can the governor's office provide us with that we should enter into some sort of a deal? How are we going to know it's going to be kept? That's my question.
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Bentz, I think it's a very fair question, one that I was expecting. I think, to be quite honest with you, this was from our work, and I think the governor's perspective, far less about a message of trust or deal making, as much as it's very much part of the intense revenue need that we have in front of our place. I think she's absolutely open to a conversation. If there are other ideas that are good ones that come from the legislature that are a better fit than this, I think she's absolutely open to those ideas. So I quite honestly would not read anything into this that a deal could not be lived up to. I think your comments about the so-called grand bargain is a appropriate definition, in that these, I believe, are the only two remaining pieces of the grand bargain that exist anymore. So I think she's absolutely open to a conversation, and whether this is the pathway forward or putting more metrics, I think that we will get more information about this particular tax credit, about the impacts that it's had on law firms and others that have not necessarily met job creation metrics or other things that would be important to consider when you have a tax expenditure like this.
Follow up.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's going to be challenging to get around this in our conversations. Mm-hmm. For the reasons I've already mentioned. So I just want to put that out there. It's probably was understood before this particular proposal was made. But a lot of problems that we got to solve, and making these arrangements is difficult enough if there's not the thought that it's actually going to stick. So we'll be looking for something, at least I will, from the governor's office that suggests that that deals can be kept. So what's that going to be, really? I don't know. But I would just send, ask you to take that message back, and we need something. So I understand the seriousness of the challenges facing this group, but being able to make deals is going to be a pretty big part of how we get out of it. So
appreciate the comment.
Thank you. Other comments or questions? Representative Johnson, please.
Vince, on the proposed liquor tax, the $39 million of net revenue or new revenue, does that account for the distribution to counties as well, because they share in those tax revenues, I believe? Is that
Chairman Representative, that's a really great question. I was hoping Paul might save me on that one. I don't think that includes the distribution to counties, but
I believe those are general fund dollars. It's
yes.
It's the extension of the bottle surcharge. So it's an extension and an increase of the bottle surcharge.
Also be an increase to counties.
Well, the,
well, correct.
I don't believe that's true. I'll ask Matt.
No.
No, the bottle surcharge, which is temporary, was designed to be general fund dollars. So the rest of the formula was unaffected.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is probably for Paul. The question is, on these suggestions, Paul, how many 36 votes are required on these? Are all these 36 votes, any of them 36 votes under the new Seattle-wide case?
Vice Chair Vince, Mr. Chair, you know, some of these we're still looking at, we'll work with counsel on. The interpretation that you were given by Dexter and Kate during the interim was that if it's a base broadening measure, such as a tax credit reduction, or it would something that reduces the size of a tax credit, it would not be. So if it's reducing a tax expenditure, it would not be. Clear around repealing, for example, the preferential rate for the Schedule E income, because at that point you do have a rate that would be increased as a result of that. So I think that may be one that would be questionable, whether that would be a supermajority or not, and one what we'll ask counsel about. If you were the IC DISC provision, which is a subtraction, as you recall, that IC DISC corporations had not been recognized in Oregon before the special session in 13, but then they became recognized by the Department of Revenue. There was a 2% corporate income tax on the entity itself, but then the dividend income that was given off that IC DISC and shared with partners had a subtraction on it. So what the governor is proposing is that subtraction be deleted. So at first blush, my reaction would be that is a base broadening measure, and not a rate change and not imposing a new tax, but rather it's adjusting a subtraction. The other measure is, of course, not extending the sunsets on some of the major tax credits that you'll be looking at, such as the residential energy tax credit, the research and development tax credit. Those would not be, because it's current law that they go away. So that's just going to be a straight sunset. The cigarette tax increase, the increase in the moist snuff tax rate, would presumably be 3/5, because you're increasing a rate that's already imposed.
May I say one other thing? One comment on the tax expenditures. I mean, some of them, it was actually very difficult to not extend them. Others, we did extend because we believe in the policy of rural medical practice. We certainly understand that the committees will take a look. At last session, there was a great example of what your committee and the Senate committee did with the Working Family Tax Credit, where you, in our frame of mind, improved on it. And so the recommendations are put forward mostly are based on policy and need on the tax expenditures, but we're absolutely open to alternate suggestions that drive the same outcome.
And we do plan, I think, to follow a procedural path similar to what we've done before, in that these bills that we just introduced that have to do with these expiring tax expenditures go first to the substantive committees for their review to determine the value of the particular policy, and then they either come back to us, or if the speaker establishes a joint committee on tax exceptions or tax credits, whatever it's called, it might go to them. So we'll see whether the policy committees agree or disagree with the governor on those items. Anything else for Mr. Porter? I understand this may be the last time we see you here in this capacity.
Chair Barnhart, that is true.
Yes. Thank you so much for your service and your great work in the film and video office and then working for the governor. I, for one, appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you, Barnhart. Representative Barnhart. I think I've set the bar appropriately that my shoes will be easy to be filled, so we should have no worries there.
Well, we might disagree on that point, but we hope that they are filled.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Update on Schedule E rate reduction impact. Legislative Revenue Office.
Mr. Chair, Chris has been working on the first preliminary significant returns for the pass-through income that we were just talking about when we got the extended returns. So he's got a first look at those, and he's going to share those with share with you those findings. This would be for the 15 tax year.
And is that among our meeting materials?
It is, yes.
What's it called?
I don't see it.
Oh, I see his marijuana.
I will upload it right now.
Okay.
Well, yeah.
Oh, there's a whole bunch more stuff that just came up on mine too.
This was in the other meeting as well.
I try to keep my computer on the public access materials so that we know what it is that our vast internet audience can actually look at while we're talking.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allenack with the Legislative Revenue Office. So as a natural follow-up to some of the discussion you just had, we have a preliminary look at tax returns and a piece of the legislation that was passed in the special session in 2013. This is the pass-through tax rate reduction. It's also part of this, some of the terminology, just so that everybody who's listening is on the same page. The reference to the pass-through rate, tax rate, and Schedule E. Schedule E is a federal tax form that contains a variety of kinds of income. It includes rental income, some passive investment income. It also contains this non-passive income, which is the focus of this policy. So that's the bridge there. And as you may recall, while it was passed and enacted in 2013, it first became effective in tax year 2015. So as taxpayers file their tax return, their 2015 returns this year, we're just now at a point where we're getting a preliminary look at the returns. The department won't be finished processing all of the returns until early 2017, but we think we have the lion's share of the returns. So this is just a first preliminary look at those returns. But before I get into the data, I just wanted to touch base on the policy description and requirements. And the basic policy objective was to provide a more favorable tax rate structure for business income by taxpayers who actively manage their businesses. And these will be businesses that are partnerships or S corporations or LLCs, the so-called pass-through entities. And they would be the net income from those entities would be available or would be subject to this lower tax rate. What the policy is not intended to do is to provide a tax cut to passive investment income or rental income. It's just that active income. So the primary requirement is that the taxpayer materially participate in the business, which is a term that is defined by the IRS in great detail. It gets into the number of hours worked and how much time spent on the business. But the basic concept is fairly simple. The taxpayer just needs to provide regular, continuous, and substantial participation in the business. They just have a hands-on role in the day-to-day of the business. Now, that policy also has a requirement that it have at least one full-time employee, and a qualifying employee is one who works at least 1,200 hours in Oregon. Those are the additional parameters on the eligibility for this provision. Again, 2015 was the first tax year, and for comparison purposes, I have two blocks up here of the income tax rates. The first block, the joint income tax rates, are our standard rate structure for joint filers. For single filers, the tax brackets are half those amounts. So this is our traditional or our regular or normal four bracket structure, where income is taxed at 5, 7, 9, and 9.9%. The first $6,700 of income beyond our standard deduction and so forth is taxed at 5%, all the way up until income above $250,000 is taxed at 9.9%. And for single filers, that $250,000 is $125,000. They're just half. So the policy here is shown in the block there on the right, the non-passive income tax rates, where the preferential rate is as low as 7% and gradually increases back up to the 9.9% as the non-passive income increases. So the taxpayer, for their first $250,000 of non-passive income, it would be taxed at 7%. And then for their next $250,000 of income, it would be taxed at 7.2%, and so on up until $5 million of non-passive income, at which point the brackets or the rate structures merge. And so for all non-passive income above $5 million, it continues to be taxed at 9.9%. That effectively puts a cap at the amount of income that is subject to the preferential rates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question because of the way you phrased that, Chris. On the left, in joint income tax rates, if my taxable income is $40,000, I pay 9% on all of that $40,000. Is that correct?
No, that is not correct. It's a marginal rate structure. So for somebody who has $40,000 of taxable income using the joint income brackets, the first $6,700 is taxed at 5%. The next $10,000 or so is taxed at 7%, and then the remaining would be taxed at 9%.
Great. Thank you. I did not realize that.
So in a very rough sense, the calculation that taxpayers and their CPAs underwent is laid out here in this table. It's a gross tax calculation. The policy is such that the taxpayer has to opt into it. They have to actively say, yes, I want to take advantage of this policy. So for comparison, the base approach, in a very high-level sense, taxpayers, they total up all of their income, they subtract their deductions, and by deductions here, I mean Schedule A deductions, and then that net income or the taxable income gets applied to those rates, and the result is gross tax. And then tax credits and so forth come after that. For the opt-in approach, for taxpayers who have this non-passive income and want to take advantage of this, they have to make two calculations to get at their gross tax. The first one is they take their non-passive income, this is their net business income, multiply it by that new rate structure, the 7 up to 9.9, and get what I've called here a gross tax B.1. Now, for all of their other income, all of their income that is not the non-passive income, they total that income, and then they subtract their Schedule A deductions from that, and that income would be multiplied by the regular rates to get at gross tax B.2. So an example of this, if you have a joint return and one spouse has non-passive income and the other spouse has wage income, you'd have those two pots of income, one of which would be subject to the preferential rates. So in the opt-in approach, both of those figures would be added, so gross tax B.1 plus gross tax B.2 would be their gross tax. And then the taxpayer presumably would then choose the lesser of gross tax A or gross tax B. At a very fundamental level, that's the calculation that's involved. So the revenue impacts, and some of these were just referenced, these are the revenue impact estimates from the 2013 special session. and we had a $38 million impact in 13-15, and that was just the first 6 months of tax year 2015, thinking that taxpayers who knew that they were going to take advantage of this might adjust their tax payments, their estimated payments, in the first 6 months of 2015, which would have that revenue impact in the 13-15 biennium. But the full impact is initially being borne here in the 15-17 biennium at an estimated $205 million and was projected to increase to about $330 million by 21-23. So the first look that we have at the 2015 returns is right here, and the key numbers here are that the estimated impact for tax year 2015 was $91 million. This $91 million shows up in here. The $38 million here is part of it, and the rest of it is embedded in the $205 million. So what we're comparing is that estimate for 2015 of $91 million, and what we're seeing from calculations made by the research section over at the Department of Revenue is that the revenue loss...
Representative Vance?
Pardon me for not asking this question earlier, but could you go back to your previous chart? And on the opt-in approach, the non-passive income, let's assume that the taxpayer has only non-passive income. That's it. Are they allowed to take into account their deductions?
No. This is part of the policy debate and discussion that occurred in 2013. Is that this is a choice they would have to choose between the preferential rates of the non-passive income and the benefit of their Schedule A deductions. So if that's, and that would be one of the considerations they would have to take, because in that case, if their only source of income is non-passive income, depending on what their Schedule A deductions are, it would not benefit, it may not benefit them to take the rates.
Follow up?
Yes, please.
It's been a long time ago, so my memory isn't what it should be, really, but I don't recall that at all. The language must be in the statute that says what you and I are debating, so I'll just take a look at that. But am I going to find it there that it basically says exactly this?
Yes. And I'm sorry, I can't recall the statute or the exact reference, but it is in the statute. It certainly should be.
Hmm. Follow up.
Yeah.
I've talked to several CPAs about this, and they disagree. But, they're not lawyers, so that probably explains it. That's a joke. I'll go back. I'll go back and take a look. Thank you.
Okay, so getting back to the 2015 returns, the $91 million was the estimate for 2015, and what we have so far is the $66 million revenue impact. So the tax cut or the revenue impact is about $25 million less than expected. Now, while we don't have, these are still preliminary, so more could come in. I don't know that we'll get to another $25 million in revenue impact. We also have anecdotal evidence, and we've heard, and the committee has heard, that there have been taxpayers who were unable to take advantage of this, either because they didn't know in time. There is that, and the key piece here is the irrevocable nature of the election, either to opt in or to not. So by the time the deadline's passed, April 15th deadline, if they hadn't claimed this or if they hadn't chosen this approach, they couldn't file an amended return and then go back and claim it. So we know there is some demand for this policy, but we don't know how to quantify that. We don't know the number of taxpayers or how much income we're talking about. So that'll be a piece of the $25 million. In looking at this in more detail, so while the actual revenue impact seems to be about 75% of the estimated impact, the distribution is very different. If we focus on the high income folks, the highest income folks, those with $500,000 or more of income, the estimate, we thought about $40 million of the $90 million impact. So about 45% of the impact would be taken by those filers. What we've seen on the returns is about $8 million more in the tax cut out of the $66 million. So it's 48 out of 66. So it's about 75% of the total impact instead of 45% of the total impact. And then also in the estimated piece, even filers with income below $50,000, we thought some of those filers would claim this incoming and take a small benefit. And what we've seen on these returns is that for the most part, all of the claimants are really start to begin at $100,000 of income. So it's the lower income folks who aren't claiming it. And we can see this also by the means here. The projected mean benefit was $1,200. And what we're seeing on the returns, it's actually about $5,000. And that's a culmination of both of those things. At the high end, the people who are claiming at the high end are claiming a larger deduction, and those at the low end aren't claiming it. So that factors into why that explains the difference in the mean there. The other piece is the number of claimants. So what we have for 2015 is about 1.7 million tax returns and 13,000 claimants. So it's just under 1% of all filers claimed it. And again, it's very concentrated at the high end. For those filers with at least $500,000 of income, there are 12,000 of those full-year filers and 3,000 of them claimed it. So 26% of those filers claimed it.
Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that shouldn't be a surprise, given what I think my earlier point, right, is that this is only going to benefit those folks that don't need those deductions at that high end. And so what a surprise. That's why when I recall when we were debating this thing, that was not in there. And if it wasn't, then we'd see a lot more low filers benefiting from this. It suggests that I wasn't the only one that was thinking that the otherwise than as that previous slide shows. But, of course, it's working out this way because of the way the deductions are not allowed until you get – so, okay, it shouldn't be any surprise to us.
Yeah, I haven't dug in. I don't know that the 26% here is far off from what we thought. There are more full-year filers. Back in 2013, the projection was around 9,000 filers, and we have about 12,000 filers. So, the reason for that are myriad, but a little more concentration.
So. Well, you have to balance, don't you? If you're a taxpayer and you're trying to figure out whether to take this or not, assuming you qualify, you have to figure out the difference in the delta of the rate and the amount of the deductions you would otherwise get if you paid the higher rate. And so you're only going to take this if the delta is small, if the deductions are small that you have, or if the delta is pretty large. And I think that's the point that Representative Benz is making. Mm-hmm. I do have a recollection that this is exactly what we agreed to, that you get the lower rate, but only if you're willing to give up your deductions. But as you look at these tables, it makes a lot of sense to me. If you have very high income, you know, deductions for your mortgage interest and property taxes and things of that sort, unless you buy a couple of mansions, probably are smaller than the rate difference would produce. Representative Benz?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And as Chris may have been just about to point out, you lose those deductions as you get higher.
Exactly.
So of course you're going to trend toward this, but the original concept was that we would have an opportunity for folks to pay a lower tax rate so they can invest in their business, and that would argue toward retooling this thing so it actually works. As opposed to what's now been suggested by our governor, that it go away. But at least we have a year to take a look at it. That's at least something.
I understand your argument now. Thank you. I hadn't understood the point you were making before.
Yeah. This table shows the distribution of the tax cut, and it highlights some of the points that were just made. For the 13,000 filers, about 10,000 of them had a tax cut that was less than $5,000. So what this table is, it's a distribution of the size of the tax cut in $5,000 increments. So the tax cut ranges from less than $5,000 to upwards of $75,000 to $80,000. And what we see is that about 10,000 of the claimants, so 74%, had a tax cut of less than $5,000. And they accounted for about 22% of the total tax cut. And it tails off pretty quickly, and we get here down to the end, or the top end there, of 75,000 to 80,000. And there, as I mentioned earlier, because the tax rates merge at $5 million of income, there is a cap to the tax cut, and that's about $76,000. Once a taxpayer gets up to a point of $5 million in this non-passive income, then that's the cap. But to Chair Vence's comments, some of that is muddied by the Schedule A deduction. So I'm kind of setting that aside for right now for the sake of illustration purposes. And so what we have there, those 36 taxpayers are either at or very close to that cap. So they had at least $5 million of non-passive income. And this is a chart sent over by the research section at DOR, and it shows a graphical representation of that point. So what we have here is the blue line, which is labeled normal tax, is simply the amount of non-passive income multiplied by 9.9%. So under most of these cases, this amount of income would be taxed at, they'd be in the 9.9% bracket. So what we have here is the non-passive income increasing up to $1 million. And then this is the amount of tax. So blue, it would be the normal. It's the 9.9% times that income. The orange is the preferential tax rates. So the difference here, we can see the tax gets reduced from the blue line to the orange line. And the green line represents that difference. So the tax cut increases as income gets to about $5 million and then levels off. And it would stay flat here. That's just a graphical way of getting at that cap for this particular policy. Now, as we mentioned before, this is income that is part of what is reported on the Schedule E. The Office of Economic Analysis, in their quarterly economic and revenue forecast, one of the components of income that they forecast is Schedule E income. They don't directly forecast this non-passive income, but it is embedded in the Schedule E forecast. So what I've shown here are the two different forecasts. The blue line is the September 2013 forecast, and so that is the forecast on which the estimates were made back in October 2013, and that's what we expected. That was our baseline projection for Schedule E income. It was about $6 billion and not really expected to move much from that over time. What we've seen, and as you've heard over on a quarterly basis, that Schedule E income has increased to about $8 billion in 2015, and with slightly declining over the next few years, but basically about a 25% increase in that base income. So as we move forward and we get into the session and the policy gets debated on the whole range of possibilities, the revenue impact will be updated according to a couple of things. One, a full examination of the 2015 returns to see how the actuals compared to the projected, as well as the change in the baseline of the Schedule E income. Because as you know, the quarterly forecast is always the base for all of our revenue impact assumptions.
We don't have any sense as to what part of this particular exemption or tax system is represented in that Schedule E forecast.
No, we have. That's correct, Mr. Chair. The 2015 returns will be our first shot at getting, okay, this is what we think it is.
What else is included in Schedule E?
Rental income and non-passive investment income.
And royalties?
I'm sorry?
Royalties?
Royalties, yeah.
Okay. And those are excluded because they're passive?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes, so all we had to go on back in 2013 to make the prediction or the estimate was Schedule E income, and we had some breakdown of the components, so that was a basis for it.
But people who are working on housing tell us that rents have been up, so one assumes that that's part of that bump.
Right, and yeah. So when the last table I have shows the impacts by county, and for 33 of the 36 counties, we had at least some taxpayers take advantage of the policy. The three that are excluded from here are Gilliam, Sherman, and Wheeler. They either had too few or perhaps even zero to show up as a specific list here. And for the most part, across the counties, the share of the filers who claimed that who were able to take advantage of the policy ranged between about 0.5% and 1%. The one outlier is Wallawa County, where just over 2% of the tax filers were able to take advantage of the policy. And as expected, most of the impact is due to the Portland area counties. The largest impact is Multnomah County in terms of gross dollars, $12.9 million, Clackamas at $12.3 million, and then Washington at $8.9 million. And then coming in fourth, we have Lane at just over $8 million in total impact.
Yeah.
And the last thing I just wanted to point out were, in because of the nature of the estimates and the uncertainty around them, embedded in the policy were two potential adjustments to the rates. These would be done by LRO, and the first one would occur by July 1, 2018, basically comparing the estimates for tax years 2015 and 2016 to the actual impact for 15 and 16. And so this first round of adjustments, if the actual is larger than the expected, then the rates would be adjusted upward such that the revenue impact would become more in line with what was anticipated. Mm-hmm. The second one, second adjustment would be based on tax years 2019 and 2020. It would occur by July 1, 2022. And this would be a potential adjustment either upwards or downwards. It's the same concept. We have estimates for, we would have estimates for 19 and 20. We would eventually have actuals, and if the actuals were either exceeded or were low, then the rates would be adjusted such that they would become more in line with the projected revenue. So if the actual were higher, then the rates would be reduced, would be increased, and if the actual impact was lower than expected, then the rates could be reduced within some bounds.
Do we have any indication about whether any of these funds were actually, the savings, the taxpayer savings were actually reinvested in the business? Do we know?
We don't know that. We have very limited information. We basically have the ability to figure out the revenue impact, and we're trying to think of ways and move forward with the possibility of trying to get at some of those eventual questions, the expected questions that will come up. What happened with these businesses? Did they invest it? What did they do with it? And we're trying to think of ways to get to those questions. We know they're going to be asked.
And do we have a way of determining the occupations or the kinds of businesses that are claiming this particular benefit?
Potentially. The taxpayers will fill out basically industry codes. And they're not always filled out. So it'll be, once we get into that level of information, we'll find out how much of that information was provided. So conceivably, it's possible we can get in there and find out, well, here's a taxpayer who took advantage of the policy and identified their business as being in a certain industrial sector or economic sector. At this point, we don't know if we'll be able to do that. So a lot of that information is not as well reported as it is on the corporate side for a lot of technical reasons. So we're holding out hope that we'll be able to get to those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Other questions for Chris? Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Let's take a 5-minute recess, and we'll return on schedule for tobacco revenue trends.
Okay, so yeah.
Committee will come back to order, and we'll start the information meeting on tobacco revenue trends.
Okay. Mr. Chair, we've asked Kyle, who actually does track the cigarette taxes and the other tobacco products, and Christine, who's been doing a lot of work on the vaping products, and have been working with a work group on the vaping products. Both of these areas, we have a fair amount of, particularly on the vaping products, activity in other states.
Wow.
So we wanted to talk some about that, and of course, the cigarette piece was a part of the governor's budget too, so, and the OTP.
Great.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kyle Eason, Legislative Revenue Office. And yes, Paul mentioned, I'll start things off with some discussion on the cigarette and the OTP side, and then Christine will pick things up from there with the vapor discussion. But so I do have a document up in OLIS, and we have it up there on the screen that I'll be referring to throughout this short discussion here. But I figured I would start off with just where we are today, where the current law is, where the distributions are, the different receipts, and then I'll get into a discussion of the changes in consumption patterns, some of the forecasts of the receipts, working from the Office of Economic Analysis quarterly revenue forecast, and then I'll finish with a comparison between Oregon and the other states on the cigarette tax side. So get into it, working from off of page one here, cigarette taxes right now, today, Oregon's at $1.32 per pack of 20 cigarettes, which is your standard size pack. And we do have a scheduled increase that we'll be picking up of 1 cent per pack that'll begin January 1st, 2018. Wow. So to just back up a little bit, you can see in the charts in the middle of the page there have the tax rates and some of the revenues going back for the last 10 years. And you can see it was beginning the 13-14 fiscal year, Oregon increased its cigarette taxes 13 cents per pack with the future schedule of two increases of a penny each additional over the next 2 years. So the first one was January 1st, 2016, and we'll pick up the next penny in 2018. And I do have the charts on the distribution so you can see where the dollars are going from the cigarette tax receipts. On the other tobacco tax side, the OTP tax side, the taxation depends in some sense on the type of product. So the largest component of the receipts is moist snuff, and that's taxed at $1.78 per ounce with a minimum tax of $2.14 per retail container. And your standard retail container, I think, is 1.2 ounces, so it comes to that 214 at the $1.78 per ounce. For the other tobacco products, so those products that are cigars, and then the other tobacco products, thinking of moist or that are not moist snuff. So shisha tobacco is maybe an example of that, the tobacco you put into a hookah. And, those are taxed at 65% of the wholesale sales price. And then the exception from the 65% is Oregon has a cap of 50 cents per individual cigar. So cigars, you can see it's in the bottom of the page there, the receipts composition. You can see the moist snuff make up about 78%. And there's cigars that are not subject to the cap. So those are your lower price cigars. In a lot of cases, these are the cigarillos. So they look in some ways like cigarettes. They come in a pack, but they're the smaller, lower-priced cigars. And then the cigars subject to the cap are more of your high-priced cigars. You're the ones you're thinking you might buy them by the box or at the individual level. But you can see the cigars against the cap make up only 1.5% or so of total receipts. So moving on to the second page of the document that's up there, I do have a couple charts on just the underlying consumption patterns, and that we'll get to the receipts in just the next page, but of course the underlying consumption patterns are going to be factored in with what the receipt outlook looks like for the excise tax. So as we've seen the percentage of adults who are current smokers decreasing, we see an overall trend of a decrease in our cigarette tax receipts over time, absent any other changes. So if you increase the tax, of course you can make changes to that, but if you make no changes, we do expect the decreasing trend to continue. And that's just following with the percentage of adults that are decreasing. And then also on the second chart I have there is the teen consumption patterns. And you can see those are coming down as well. So overall consumption of cigarettes has definitely been decreasing over time. And we still seeing that, although the numbers are starting to get to a point to be pretty low. But we're still seeing those decreases year over year.
I'm not sure I understand. Just let me ask. So the lifetime number is, have you ever smoked anything at all? Is that the question that gets you that blue line?
Yes, Mr. Chair, yeah.
Okay, all right. Then the rest of it I can understand. Yeah, within the last 30 days, today, and a half a pack or more a day. Okay,
yes.
I got it. Thanks.
Yeah, and these numbers come, it's the University of Michigan, the Monitoring of the Future, and this would be a composition of, I think it's 8th, 10th, and 12th grade is the survey that goes out there.
Right.
And I do have in the bullet, I think it's the last bullet there, it does discuss on the smoking prevalence among teens. When you're talking just cigarettes, for any smoking a cigarette at any point in the last 30 days was 6.7%. But if you factor in those small cigars, it goes up to about 11.2%. And again, the cigarette revenue would come in on the cigarette side, and then the smaller cigars would be the OTP revenue. So just something to keep in mind there. And then moving on to the third page, and this is where seeing the consumption patterns, you then see that.
Now this is based on self-report, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. So the previous the page two information comes from a combination of it's survey data. Yeah. So yeah. So on the receipt side, you can see the blue line are the receipts that we have. So these are actual that have come in the door. And then the red line is that's the forecasted receipts. So these for the top two charts you see there, those are coming from the Office of OEAs. Again, their quarterly revenue forecast. And you can see cigarette tax receipts. We do have the 1 penny increase still upcoming, but the overall trend is receipts going down year over year. On the OTP side, OEA is forecasting a modest upward trend. And then the next two charts I have on, still on page three, are the interaction between Oregon and Washington. Mm-hmm. So we do see quite a bit of a cross-border effect. If I'm moving to the bottom right, you can see Oregon and Washington's tax per pack on the cigarette side. And you can see Washington has had a number of increases in the past 15 years or so, and Oregon picked up the 13 cents, but has been, I guess, more flat over the past 15 years. And the difference today is about $1.71 per pack in terms of the excise tax.
Oh, yes, Representative Nuss, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just really curious, just really quick. Does the Washington tax situation reflect an additional tobacco tax on top of their sales tax, or is it, like, separate, or...?
Yes, Representative Nose, the what I have there on the chart is just the excise tax itself. It doesn't include the sales tax, so that would widen the gap even more so.
Okay.
And that is on the chart, I guess, of the four charts, is the one on the lower left. It has the millions of packs sold in Oregon, which is the blue line, and then the packs sold in Washington. And then the green dotted line is actually working off the right vertical axis, is the difference between the two. So as that green line goes up, the percent difference between Oregon and Washington is greater. So that means Washington is more, a pack of cigarettes is more costly in Washington than it is in Oregon. And that can be, that's a combination of factors. That's in part the excise tax. It's also the sales tax as well that Washington has. So there is definitely a cost difference. And we've seen that in Washington puts out these estimates as well, as there is certainly a significant number of Washingtonians that cross the border to purchase cigarettes here in Oregon. Mm-hmm.
And of course, they pay the use tax.
So then moving on to the last page, I have the 50 states and the District of Columbia, and then I've also listed the measures that were on the most recent November ballot. So there was we have four states that had measures on the November ballot. California was the one state that did pass a tax increase on their cigarettes, and they actually passed a tax increase on cigarettes and OTP. As well, and Christine will get into the vapor products discussion. And in addition to that, back in earlier in the spring, California also raised their age up to 21 to purchase tobacco products. So you can see in the chart, I have Oregon, it's the red line. In about the middle of the page there, it's Oregon's number 30 in terms of excise taxes. The other red bar I have near the bottom is the new tax for California. So they voted to increase taxes by $2 per pack. So they went from about number 37 at 87 cents per pack to they'll be at 287 effective in April. So they'll be jumping up to near 8 or 9 in terms of states with the tax. You'll see Washington's also near the top at number 7. Again, Oregon's in the middle, number 30, and then Idaho is at 45. So excise receipts are still less.
Representative Vance.
Kyle, can you go back to your Oregon, Washington tax cigarette packs sold? Is that how do we make sure it's just Oregon people buying when we're sure so many Washington people are coming in? Do you have some sort of you take a bunch out?
No, Representative Vance, that would include any stamped cigarette that's sold here in Oregon. So if it's sold to Washingtonians, that's included in the base there. So that's included in the Oregon blue line would be whatever's being sold. If Washingtonians crossing the border buying the cigarettes, they're paying Oregon's tax. So we pick them up in the receipts there.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the That chart right there, millions of packs, shows the blue line going above Washington, but in point of fact, we could be following them down just identically, and we're just inflating the number by virtue of Washington people buying Oregon cigarettes.
Yes, that's correct, Representative Vance. You can see it was in about 96 when Washington actually had a dip and Oregon had an increase in the total number of packs sold. And you can see that trend as it fluctuates between the cost between the two states. That narrowing, yeah, certainly is in part with Washington. Is they're exporting some of their consumption to Oregon. And the way some of the estimates work on this is they can look at the survey data, and certainly on average, individuals in Washington consume tobacco products slightly less than those in Oregon, but it doesn't make up for enough of the difference. They're just certainly not buying enough taxed product in Washington to explain their consumption. And we are purchasing more taxed products than would it be explained for our consumption. So you can definitely tell the cross-border,
Well, and there is an interesting correlation, isn't there, between tax changes and the shift between Oregon and Washington. You mentioned one of them, 1996, but there's one in 2011, it looks like, or 10 as well. A very similar kind of shift. Representative Vance?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The justification, of course, is if we raise the tax, fewer people will smoke. But if the trend is down, we might have to seek other justifications. It looks as though we haven't been raising our tax, but the trend is down. That's my point.
Yeah, Representative Vance, I believe in most, throughout the nation, yeah, the trend is definitely down. And I should have mentioned these, the consumption pattern figures on page two are nationwide trend figures. But yeah, the overall trend, certainly in consumption of tobacco products, is decreasing.
And a follow-up.
Yep, please.
Yeah, because 9 years of sitting here having this debate, forgive me for repeating myself, but the justification for the tax, any tax, is that somehow we're going to reduce the chances of the kids smoking. If that's not the good justification, then all we're really doing is I have a number of people that work in our law firm are so addicted they can't quit. I mean, they simply can't. So what I'm seeking again, of course, is the proof that, well, they can't quit. They're stuck, and we're just using them as an annuity for the state. But maybe kids, we can fool ourselves into thinking that this is going to prevent some of them from smoking. But if this chart would suggest, perhaps that's not what's happening. That's the question, because we hear it every time in this. We're going to hear it again. So just asking the economists as opposed to the all the interest groups are going to have flooding in here talking about why all the heart surgery, all the lung, all those people. So, but you're not one of them. You're an economist. So if we, does this chart suggest that raising the tax is not going to affect that downward trend any more than just watching the older demographic pass away and the younger people not smoke?
Yeah, Representative Vance, so when we do our modeling, we do take into account that if you increase the tax, you will increase the price and you will have a decrease in consumption. So you would, I guess it would be, you will increase that decrease. So if there's a declining trend, you will cause that to decline faster. So there will still continue to be fewer people to smoke. And one of the things, a point to take from this chart, of course, is if you are to increase Oregon's tax, you will bring it in some way at least closer to parity with Washington. Even if it's a penny, you get a little bit closer. You could see on the receipt side here in Oregon actually decrease more than just the consumption decrease of Oregon residents, because we'll be losing some of that Washington. So it's a little, I guess you could say, it's a little more costly in some ways when you raise your tax in terms of the decreasing receipts, because you're losing some of those Washingtonians.
Follow up?
No, Mr. Chair, I'm going to guess we're going to have lots of opportunity for this discussion.
Well, I expect we will. Representative Nose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just since we're sharing anecdotes, I would just say that having a teenage son who unfortunately spent time abroad in Chile, where young people have access to cigarettes and smoke pretty regularly, he picked it up there, unfortunately. And what I'll tell you is that he and his friends, when they're very price sensitive, and when the price of cigarettes go up, they switch to vaping products, which at the moment are more affordable and we don't tax.
Oh, another topic for you, Representative Vance.
So it's the trend seems to be that young people are switching to vaping. They're not smoking. They're they're using the vape products.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just take the opportunity to say as well that I think even if the, just to reinforce Kyle's economist view of it, which is to me, even though the trend is going down, the more and the faster we can push down, the better. And as someone who smoked for 20 years myself and went through a period where I thought I was addicted and I thought I was never going to quit, but indeed, price sensitivity can, it can inspire you even when even when you think it isn't. So,
interesting point. The point I would make, of course, is that we know that that healthcare costs for smokers are significantly attributed significantly contribute to the cost of the Oregon Health Plan and of course private insurance as well. And so we spend some of these dollars on healthcare, which is an appropriate thing for us to do. And if the dollars went away because the taxes were high enough that nobody smoked, well, presumably our health costs would go down as well, probably greater degree than the loss in revenue. So at least that's the argument that's made, Representative Vance. We'll see.
We should try.
We'll see. Please go ahead.
I think that's a great.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I just wanted to say something as a takeaway from someone who's retiring. My favorite sentence, I think, of the years on revenue is, "You'll increase the decrease."
Oh, I was going to try to use Representative Nose's question or statement actually as a great segue to Christine with the vapor products.
Yes. Please.
Speaking of vapor, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Christine Broniak with the Legislative Revenue Office. I have done some estimates for potential taxing, various options for taxing vapor products. I found that the rates of smoking in Minnesota were highly similar to those in Oregon, and they've also had their vapor tax in place for a number of years. So I thought that I would base my model off of Minnesota. And so what I did was I looked at their tax, which was 95% of the wholesale rate, and applied some factors to that to kind of adjust for population and assume what such a tax rate might look like in Oregon. Also applied some growth rates into the future. I used some numbers from Wells Fargo. You might remember Barney Herzog's presentation last fall. And so I was able to kind of come up with some revenue estimates for various tax regimes in Oregon. So the first one I would consider was a tax rate of 65% of the wholesale. So this was similar to a proposal that was in the legislature that would add e-cigarettes to the definition of tobacco products and therefore bring about a 65% of wholesale tax. And in a full biennium in 1921, this would bring in about $31.6 million in revenue. Another possibility with these wholesale taxes is to implement that tax instead on the retail amount. And so there's an equivalent there. So if the markup were 100%, the retail tax that would bring in that amount of revenue is 33% of retail. If the markup were only 50%, the tax that would bring in that revenue is 43% of retail. And then I looked at a tax rate that is 95% of wholesale, so this is more on par with the Minnesota rate. And that was is just proportional, so 95% is greater than 65%, and $46.2 million in a full biennium is the revenue estimate for that one. And at 100% markup, a retail tax of 48% would be equivalent. But at a 50% markup, the retail tax would be 63% in order to be equivalent to that. Yet another approach to this is to maybe look at a tax per milliliter. I modeled the 20 cents per milliliter tax. This is something that is applicable in Kansas. And using that tax per milliliter in Oregon, I estimate that a full biennium would bring in $15.6 million. And so that's a little bit more straightforward than maybe trying to understand a little better about what the markups are and translating wholesale into resale. The final possibility, or just another possibility, final possibility presented here, is to apply a tax based on the estimated nicotine absorption in vapor products versus cigarettes. And I used some studies on the absorption of nicotine. It turns out, now these numbers are highly uncertain. You could have one study with certain parameters and then do another study with different parameters and have it change. It's highly sensitive. But sort of as a rough estimate, it was estimated that cigarettes, the user absorbs about 10% of the nicotine. And in vapor products, the absorption rate is higher at 50%. And so through some sorts of conversions there, I came up with around 4 milliliters of e-liquid at the kind of the average concentration. That's 12 milligrams per milliliter. I came up with that amount as the equivalent of a pack of cigarettes, and then looked at the $1.33 per pack tax on cigarettes that we have in Oregon, and applied that then to these vapor products. And the result there is $28.4 million in a full biennium in revenue. But that's not really thought to be perfectly equivalent. There's a lot of uncertainty in that equivalency. And also, the nicotine harm only represents a portion of the health concerns related to either vapor products or cigarettes. There's other compounds in both of those products that might be of concern. There's more of a body of evidence on cigarettes and some of the compounds in vapor products. They're still kind of waiting a little bit more to get evidence that this one or that one causes cancer. But so that there's a lot of outstanding science all around that estimate, so that things yet to be seen. So the next thing, I went through a lot of other states and District of Columbia's taxes on vapor products, and just looking at all of the differences between those states and comparing and contrasting kind of brought up a few interesting policy kinds of questions that maybe that are on the plate for Oregon if they consider this. So first I'll just run through the states to kind of talk about the structures that are in other states. The first one is Minnesota, and the tax there is 95% of the wholesale price. It's collected at the distributor level, and we'll get to this later. It's turned out to be very problematic to do that. I talked to some folks there, and they kind of advised that Oregon do something differently. I'll get to that later. So vapor liquids that don't have nicotine in them are not taxed. Devices are not taxed unless they come prepackaged with the liquid inside. So the disposable e-cigarettes are the only cases where you would pay the tax on the device itself. So the problem they brought up was an enforcement problem, because out-of-state or international distributors are responsible for paying the tax. And if the distributor is out of state and says they don't want to pay the tax, it's possible to, you know, maybe go after them, but it takes resources to do that. And if there are too many of them and it ends up being that the costs are greater than the benefits, it could just be that their noncompliance goes unpunished or unnoticed. Also, if a distributor is internationally based, it is really hard to go after them. So there could be a real loss of revenue from that, and also a bit of a market distortion where an organization that imported vapor products from an entity that doesn't pay taxes is at an advantage compared to someone that imports from one that is tax compliant. So the next state that I would talk about is North Carolina. There is a 5 cents per milliliter tax on liquid. There is no tax on devices and no tax on liquids that do not contain nicotine. So they have language that's a little bit more typical for the person who's responsible for the payment of the tax. They say the wholesale dealer or retail dealer that first acquires the item in the state is liable for the tax. So it's a bit easier to enforce within one's own state, or a lot easier. Louisiana has a 5 cents per milliliter tax on liquid, and this tax is payable by the first business to sell or possess vapor products. Liquid without nicotine is not taxable, but they have an interesting aspect of their taxation system. When retailers mix their own liquid, they pay tax on the amount of the finished product instead of paying on the original concentrated nicotine volume. So this is in contrast to Minnesota's system, where the tax is paid on the concentrated nicotine, and then they would only pay tax on that little vial, but then they would add all this other value from mixing that. Maybe one or two drops go into the flavored vapor product, and all that additional value is not taxed. But Louisiana has a mechanism by which they tax the total amount. They actually have them wait to pay the tax until they actually sell their finished product. Moving on, Kansas has a little bit higher of a tax per milliliter. And this one includes both liquids containing nicotine and liquids without nicotine. The statute refers to consumable product and doesn't reference nicotine. The District of Columbia has a tax that's 67% of the wholesale price. And it's that familiar language again, the first person to possess or sell the vapor products in the district. And the tax applies to devices completely, even if they are sold separately from vapor products. And it excludes some accessories such as battery chargers. So that's a different approach to devices than the states before. But it could increase revenue to be able to tax devices themselves. Pennsylvania had a tax of 40% of the wholesale price of disposable e-cigarettes and liquid cartridges. The tax is strictly paid by the retailer. Components are taxable even if packaged without liquids. And liquid without nicotine in it is taxable as well. That's also another option to do is to make the tax applicable to flavored liquids as well as liquids containing nicotine. The science is still uncertain, but it's possible that there are hazardous substances in that vapor, substances other than nicotine that might cause problems. So the most recent one, also Kyle mentioned that Proposition 56 in California, where the cigarette tax was raised by $2, but they've also added electronic cigarettes to the definition of tobacco products. And liquid is only taxed if it contains nicotine. And they've also done the option to tax devices even if sold separately. And the tax there on tobacco products is kind of interesting. It's a percentage of the wholesale price, and that's to be based on the ratio of cigarette taxes to the cigarette wholesale prices. And it's yet to be determined what the levels of taxation are going to be, but it's going to be expressed as a percentage of wholesale price, and it would change annually depending on the cigarettes and the ratio there. And finally, West Virginia has a 7.5 cent per milliliter tax on all liquids, whether they contain nicotine or not, and that is payable by the first entity to receive the product in the state. Another issue to consider is whether to implement this as a floor tax, which would mean that when the effective date of some sort of tax would come around, that then the retailers would have to pay for all of the product on their floor. This makes it a little bit easier to administer. because the other option is to only tax retailers or wholesalers or whoever is being taxed, or to only tax them on their new orders after the effective date. But that does open up the possibility for some amount of cheating, where they can maybe switch products and say that one's been there for longer than it has. It can create a bit of an enforcement difficulty. But that's pretty much a summary of some of the policy choices that come with this type of tax. And so with that, I could take any questions.
I think this area is pretty problematic because if your tax is based on the amount of material contained, then it would seem to me that would encourage people to concentrate the nicotine and sell smaller vials with more nicotine in it, if it could be done that way. I find this all very confusing, and I think we're going to need, if we want to pursue this, I don't know if we are or not, but if we are going to pursue it, we ought to figure out some argument or some justification for a comparison between this and tobacco products. I mean, this is just off the top of my head, and also the enforcement issues. I mean, it seems to me that if enforcement becomes much harder if you tax only nicotine-containing liquids and not everything else that might go into an e-cigarette, because if with that you have to analyze the product in order to know whether it's taxable or not. Mm-hmm. Whereas if, on the other hand, you tax anything that goes into the e-cigarette, it doesn't matter. You don't care whether it has any nicotine in it or not. Unless somebody's doing the studies to figure out how to do this in a way that actually accomplishes our goals, I think that it's still something that's going to be subject to politics and policy. And I'll tell you, any advice that LRO has on how to levy a tax and how to actually collect it and how to do it in a way that deals with the differential use between e-cigarette products and regular tobacco products, and what that means, if anything, in terms of health issues, I think would be valuable to have. And I don't think we're anywhere close to that yet, based on what you've reported.
Well, Chair Barnhart, one thing that comes to mind, the FDA has recently put out a set of regulations to apply to the e-cigarette industry, and it's requiring them to certify each product that's made. It's thought that it's really going to cut down on the types of mom and pop shops who are mixing their liquids in the back room. They're actually going to be required to certify what is in each product, so that would go a long way to standardizing or at least confirming that there's nicotine in a liquid. Also, just anecdotally, just a friend of mine happened to mention he loves his vapor pen, and I said, well, why didn't you just get the really strong stuff and never have to puff more than once or twice? And he said it tastes very bitter, and so once you start getting into those higher concentrations, the popular appeal may not be there for, you know, real high concentration nicotine products. That tends to be something that people do when they are first coming off of cigarettes and need something very strong. May not be as pleasant for the user as, you know, bubble gum or cherry flavor.
Right. Thank you.
And to Mr. Chair, I think what we're starting to see is the list that Christine's put together is we're starting to see a growing number of states actually implement something.
Yeah.
And that I think will give us some information down the road.
And if you have good connections with the people who are doing the administration in those states, we can figure out which ones are getting it right and which ones aren't. Because you certainly can't tell from this material, can you? At this stage, at least. Representative Nose, please.
Well, there was a work group that, thank you, Mr. Chair, there was a work group that was meeting about this, and I remember you saying the state of Minnesota suggestion to us was that we do it in a retail approach, which is a political decision and fraught with some controversy, but do you remember why they thought that was a better approach?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Nose, they said that really you want the entity that's in the state somehow. You want the entity responsible for the tax to be in the state. Because if they're international, they may pay out of just general, good behavior. If they're out of the state, they may pay, but they may also not pay. And it's possible to go after them, but it may cost something. And it may not be feasible to go after each and every non-compliant out-of-state entity. So if someone is in the state, it's easier to make them comply with the taxes. Also, maybe a system of I've seen some other states implement a system where there's a license to sell favored products, and that license would be something like an additional incentive to pay taxes. Mm-hmm. The person could lose their license, so they would pay. But definitely want them to be in state.
Thank you. Let's. I'm conscious of the time, and I'd like to get you out by 5. So why don't we move on to marijuana review update?
Mr. Chair, we've got both. Nazan's going to talk about kind of the status of where we are in terms of the work that the Joint Marijuana Committee has done. Representative Leininger and Representative Helm have been very involved in that, but this committee is not really. So to give you some background, and then Deanna will talk about what we see in terms of collection to this point. Of course, Department of Revenue is the collection agency, and also some discussion about administrative issues and that we are somewhat familiar with, but to give you an update on where they're at in terms of collecting that revenue.
Great.
Afternoon.
You're always at the cutting edge, Madison.
Chair and members of the committee, I was hoping to start at 4:20, but 4:25 is all right. This is, of course, the issue have not come through the revenue committee with the taxation issue and so on, and it went through the joint committee with Representative Leininger and Representative Helm being subjected to this a lot of this material that I've wanted to kind of quickly share with you. And I just want to mention that a lot of the federal stuff with the call memorandum and all the federal, I put it in the bottom of the presentation just in case you wanted to look at it, but I'm not going to go through it. It is good stuff anyhow. When we were looking at the legal marijuana in Oregon and the taxation, we, of course, have to talk about three main issues, which is Measure 91, how it all started, the 2015 fixes by the Joint Committee, which probably was 200 pages of statutes, and then the 216 legislation, and then we'll touch quickly on current issues, and that's where Deanna will come. And the, of course, in the 2014, the Measure 91 came with, as you know, was IP 53. It came with a $35 per ounce of tax, and then, looked at leaves and plants and so on. And it put the age restrictions and then the distributions. And then there was two other initiatives that actually did not make it. Those two initiatives, one was more of a different type of legalization, and the other one was a kind of legalization that had to copy almost the OLCC liquor and not beer and wine, but the liquor way of doing things with the government controlling the substance and so on. But that didn't go through. So that basically opened up all these questions for us. And, as government type of regulation, economics, and so on. The question was, what kind of role for the government that we're actually looking for in the marijuana? Is it something that the government enters into the market just like SAFE, for example, where it actually offers workman comp in addition to other companies? Does it establish monopoly in the level of the state-controlled OLCC, or is it, you know, the type of beer and wine that allows private entities to work and then just regulate it through the transportation industry? And then, of course, is it a utility market? Is it a regulated market through natural monopoly type of thing? And how do we turn those black markets into gray markets? So the main thing is the market, as we know it, it already exists. I mean, there is already a market for this stuff. This is not something that is being introduced that nobody knows about. And the market is primarily black, meaning it's in the dark, which means, you know, the suppliers and the consumers and the are basically transacting and asking for, you know, getting all the amounts that they want. There is a demand, or what we call here is quantity demanded. We're not looking at the demand graph yet. So the other thing that we need to know is the supply. Of course, the supply in Oregon is probably bigger than what Oregon market is. So finding the supply is not going to help if you don't equate that with the demand side. So the demand estimate as we have it, so what is the quantity demanded? I remember the time that the first we started looking at this back in 2010, really, or 2009, 2010, as revenue options, and we estimated the time of how much actually there is a demand. And we thought, based on different studies and papers, that there is about 2 million ounces of demand in Oregon, 2 plus or minus million ounces of marijuana. So that's at that time what we thought there is. And, of course, we accepted the notion that with legalization, basically there will come a decrease in price or a fall in price. Mm-hmm. Prices will fall. That is probably not true anymore. So that all is dependent on the idea of you have a market, you have actors in the market, you have supply and demand, and it's all in the dark, and all of a sudden you come and turn the light on. Is it okay? Now you're in the light. Now you pay taxes. You keep transacting the way that you are, but you pay taxes. But of course, you know, it's if you do that and you have 2 million, you have $35 per ounce, you should expect about $70 million in taxes if they start immediately complying to what you do. And you probably have heard that number before. We've given that number in 2010. However, those numbers just never die, and they kept coming back at us and saying, 70 million, 70 million. Okay, well, let's look at it differently because, you know, regrettably and unfortunately, things don't work as rational as economists would like them to do. So we can't just turn on the light and the market will comply. So the nature, how we look at the estimates of that market is we looked at the number of current users, who's using, who's over 21, because remember, we're trying to restrict this to 21 above. How much do they consume? And then estimate that price of the black market or, you know, the market period in order to be able to see how much the regulated market or the legal market price would be and how they would compete. So then you would add what additional users would come out of induced use. This is the new stuff that people who no longer think of it as a bad thing to do. And then, you know, take, you know, the different statistics and put them together to try to estimate the size of the market. So we get different estimates from surveys. And those are the surveys for, you know, two groups of people, you know, the Oregonians and the U.S., basically above, below 18 and above 18, and how much they use of the products. And you just, you could see how in Oregon, all from all the different groups you have, primarily everywhere, Oregon use is higher than the national use. But in this area, this is where the whole, this is where the bulk of the issue is, basically. So those are the number of days that are used per year, and that's the percentage. So what this is saying is about 4-some percent of Oregonians use about 21 to 60 days out of the year. And of course, about 3.5% used at almost every day. So the age groups that you know we have, that's a percentage also of use. We're trying to still identify how many are there. Now this is for these age groups, 21 to 25, and then the 26 and above. These are the numbers that we have for population, and we establish, you know, primarily how many, you know, the percentages that we saw before, and we get these are the numbers of users that we've identified accordingly. So, you, these if that's if, the, if these are the people who use, who comes out? Comes out first, of course, anybody under 21, because we are not going to tax that. Even if they use it, we're still not going to be able to tax it. And then the medical users. The medical users are going to be exempt. And you would have them divided also between the 21 and 25 groups. And then there are a group that would always use their horticulture or, you know, grow their own type of thing. And that we would estimate based on some other studies at 8%. So we would have these amounts of people actually coming out of the estimates. So also we have then established number of users, made all the subtractions. We have the net users, if you want. Then we would have here how much we know about them. So we have two groups of users. We have the what's so called super users, and we have the occasional users. And the super users are very heavy users, basically. And then the occasional users are probably less. You have 11.8 grams, while for men and women does you know less at 11.1. So. Those are the ones what we call the occasional. Then you have the new group coming at about 4%, and that gives you about 72,000 ounces per year. And then of course you add the occasional rate used to in order to allow it to trigger with the rest of the estimates. So basically, you put all these things together. And you have, you know, the amounts of ounces that we're looking at instead of what we looked at before at 2 million is about, you know, 1.9 million ounces of that. So, now remember, Oregon has a unique way of sharing things. We're in a sharing economy kind of thing, and even that extends to cannabis. And you know the way we it's delivered is primarily it's through a friend, it's through a relative. 91% of that delivery is through somebody you know. It's your neighborhood friendly supplier. So that what that does is you would basically is that you're competing if you're trying to put this through a regulated market, you will be competing with that network. You're trying to establish a new network for supply. So the prices in the regulated market, we put them through the different ways that the price would be affected. We also emphasized and modeled the impact of the federal tax 280E implications, which is the ability to deduct your cost of business, cost of doing business. And now that, of course, on the federal level, that still is the case. We dealt with it with some in the state, but not. But this was a little before we were able to do that. Then we put all these estimates in these models to try to actually do a lot of the modeling of how the price is going to come out. And if you're really interested in that, we have it in the Measure 91 research report. You could look at those. At the end, we looked at the different markup levels of the supplier, the processors and retailers, which left two other nodes of distribution around, which is the wholesalers and the the producers. And then we got the amounts or the prices under these assumptions, and those assumptions, once we got those prices, try to use the elasticity that you've been talking about with tobacco. And remember, the elasticity with tobacco that we talk about in Oregon is about 0.6%, and we call this inelastic. So unit elastic is each 1% moves the demand 1%. If it's below 1, it's inelastic. If it's above 1, it's elastic. This is very inelastic. Tobacco is very inelastic, so it will make people do it less, but not that much. Same thing that would happen with marijuana. We thought from different estimates and different studies, it's about 0.7 to 0.75. We run that through a level of different amounts of models, and we ran it through a few times, and we took basically what we thought would be the new market share of what the legal product would be under the, let's say, the assumptions of Measure 91. So it's about right here. So primarily the impacts of legalization under Measure 91 would have been to immediately push one-third of the market to the legal market. The rest would stay with your, as you saw, your friendly family neighborhood supplier. So having that gray market, being primarily about $177 per ounce, they will return about two-thirds of the market. And then, we add all these different new additions. That's what we had for Measure 91 at that time. We said the unit of a year unit of estimate is about 21 million or so. And we looked at different increases at different times for those estimates. And this would have been our forecast under different assumptions of how much the legalization takes place. And at the highest level, we thought that 10% of the market being per year taken by the legal market from the illegal market or the illicit market, you would, in a few years, quickly get to about $45 million a year in tax revenue.
Oh, yes, Representative, what's it?
So I have a question. Since California just legalized it, how's that going to impact, I assume, right, they just legalized marijuana. How will that impact our projected revenue? Because they don't have to buy it here anymore. They can, as our neighboring states, start to legalize it seems like it would cause our revenue to go down.
Well, Representative would say that although that is correct, California, the market or the medical market that is so developed and well established that the incentive for consumers to come to Oregon exists, but it's not huge.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So in order for people to leave their place of market, it's not only the pull, but you need to be pushed. Yeah. And they have such a developed medical market that you probably are not going to have that impact so much. So in 2015, the House Bill 2041, as Senator spearheaded that, changed that $35 tax on the producer to about 17% on retailers and leaving $3 for local option. Then we have, under that assumption, we built all different estimates on how that affects the price and where it comes to be, and we thought it will bring the price down because the tax does not amplify through the different nodes of process that it goes through. So you don't start by paying $35 on a tax, and then when you sell it to the other step of the process of the markup, it doesn't mark that with it too, which ends up with a lower price at the end. And we thought it would be probably $277 to about, rather than $320 for Measure 91 estimate. And of course, now if you look today at the price amounts, you find the gram is to be about $10 to $14 on average. Remember, the ounce is about 28.5 grams. So $10, that's about $285. But that's by the gram. The more you buy, the less there is. So I think looking at how we estimated all of that, I think the estimate for the price came pretty close. Then House Bill 3400 gave the opt-out provisions for counties that had different outcome on the vote or at a certain level. That took out about 8% of the population, and also, to my count today, and that might not be exactly accurate at this point yet, because the latest election results probably not all that I had tabulated, but it's about 87 cities that opted out, and you take about all of this puts about 14.5% of the Oregon population outside areas that are legal to buy, produce, and so on. Now, that of course doesn't stop. People are mobile and they could go around and so on. But if that was, 1% change in the revenue would probably be about $200,000. So in the House Bill 2041 point of sale at 17% plus 3% for cities and counties, yes. That's the revenue estimates that we had at that time. Remember, we have this was starting in 1/1/2017. So there was not until later on comes the early start. And the estimate for 17-19 is about $62 million, which tells you that we were expecting about $31.5 million per year for revenue at 17% for the state. So we started, Senate Bill 460 came to give the Early Start Program. And the Early Start Program said October 1st, we allow you to sell until the end of the year with no tax. And then starting the beginning of the year until the end of the year, you pay 25% tax on if you're selling. And only this is for the medical dispensaries. So if you put the new forecast, basically we thought this is, since it's lower price, it definitely changed the amounts and the forecast outlook. And you remember the one we showed you for Measure 91 was at 40-some million. So this would probably, if it continues the same, we would get to about $60 million by about 2022 per year of revenue. So that is definitely a significant expansion on the legal market and taken away from the illegal market. Now, remember, the way this thing works is the market already exists. If the price goes, people don't stop smoking or just don't stop consuming. What they do is go to the other market. So it's like a discrete switching market rather than, you know, a regularly sloped demand curve. So at the end, legislative session 2015, and I'm going to go through this pretty quickly. So you would have what we thought is there is the 10% in the Senate Bill 460, as we mentioned, and we thought the Senate Bill 460 gives you slight risks because the Senate Bill 460, although it gave the chance to the medical dispensary to get rid of their inventory and so on, it had two, a blessing and a curse, if you will, right? And the blessing is that we could actually get, it's as close as you get to turning on the light, because these are things that are happening today. You just put a whole new supply into the market and allow people to buy it. The regulation structure that was built through House Bill 2041 has not been established to govern the Early Start program. So there wasn't labs and testing and so on yet. And remember, the new product, or the legalized product, is not going only to compete on price, but it's going to compete on quality, because it's very high quality. It is going to compete on safety of the product. It's going to compete on security. I mean, you know, if my kid has to do this, they go to a well-lit store and so on. I mean, it's different than... So these are the things that it's going, and not only that, but it's going to cap the market at a price, because the illegal market cannot sell above the legal market. Why would anybody go and buy it for the same price from somebody on the corner street rather? So it's pushing down that illegal market. And all of that, Senate Bill 460 kind of, in a way, gave us a size of the market, but in the same time, it kind of created expectations that things might not be as well regulated as it would be under the new system that will be established and the OLCC will get or will start implementing. Finally, in the 2016 session, there was Senate Bill 1601 that allowed for medical cardholders not to pay tax even if they buy from commercial establishment. House Bill 4414 made the canopy restrictions and the residency removed it and so on. House Bill 1494 also is an important, and I think Department of Revenue and a number of state agencies are working and meeting continuously to try to find a way that allows for the banking establishment and the banking industry to provide that service for the new marijuana industry. And that was mandated by House Bill 1494, and they probably will come back at a certain time and give that report to the legislature. Senate Bill 1511. And actually allowed the processed products to be done. Now, we updated the cost and revenue. You have also a copy of that update because the cost at that time, in 2015 and 2016, it took a long time before we were able to see all these costs from these all agents, six different agencies. And we were only looking at this Early Start program, which was very difficult, very problematic, and we looked at it only on the net. But then we were able to see all of that and see most of the costs that were to incurred were basically allocated to fees and licenses rather than drawing from the tax, which freed up a whole bunch of the tax that we assumed otherwise paying for administration to be distributed when distribution comes. So at this time, as we updated, we were looking at fiscal year 2016 to be about $22 million, and the 32 basically about 55 million for the biennium. And as you could see, 17-19, we have not changed that estimate. And of course, it seems like that is the revenue is coming stronger. And I'll leave that in a few minutes for Diane to tell you about. And the
which we'll need to get to pretty soon if she's going to have any time today.
And basically, that's let me give her that time, since we have a very quick update of where the licenses and happening are. The general idea about licensing and what is happening, that we could expect things to start working soon, but we might be looking at slight fits and starts and things that might or might not work exactly as they do. And this is just like a new program being started. It is not unusual, and it probably will have those difficulties.
Thank you. He didn't leave you much time, but give us what you can.
Well, luckily, you know I speak fast. Will you pull up my presentation, yeah. Mazin, please? For the record, I'm Deanna Mack with Department of Revenue. And just at a really high level, because I do have a lot of material, but I'll do my very best to keep it short. Right now...
And we'll have you back again.
Okay. Right now, we're in this window of time where we have both early start running, and we also have sales for retail dispensaries. Licenses have been issued by the OLCC. I believe 74 as of the last notice I saw. So we do have some people who are in the window of time where they're collecting the 25% tax, but they're also collecting the 17% tax, depending on whether they are licensed or not. The tax in the retail stores, it's all collected at the point of sale. The retail stores are collecting it. They have a seed-to-sale tracking system that's unlike the system in the early start program. Like Mazin was saying, it's not as heavily regulated. So the harvest, it's all the way through to the end of the process. There are retailers that are going to be having to file two tax returns this quarter. If they are collecting both the 25% tax and the 17% tax, there are different means to do that. Right now, the returns are required to be filed quarterly, and the deposits, monthly deposits, are required. We didn't want these folks to have to be traveling with so much money because they do have to come to Salem to our secure facility to make deposits. So we modeled it after our withholding tax program with monthly deposits and quarterly tax return filing. There has been some confusion around, I think some of these folks think that the making of the payment is the filing of the tax return, and that is not correct. We've had some issues with some compliance related to filing enforcement. It's on one of my later slides. But we're educating them as they come forward. We're reaching out to them, talking to them about what we can do. The banking issue is the biggest issue, as you're probably aware. Most of the I think we're somewhere between 55 and 60% of the payments are coming in cash. And this is what we're hearing from our partners as part of the work group on the 4094, House Bill 4094, as well as our financial institution partners, that as long as it is on the Controlled Substances Act, banking will be an issue, whether even if it's just lowered to a different schedule, because there's at no time would recreational marijuana be allowed for that purpose. So until they take it off of the Controlled Substances Act, we're going to have an issue with banking. In Oregon, currently, we only have one community credit union that is willing to bank these folks. Well, our partners in Washington and Colorado have several more financial institutions that are willing to take on that risk. For the most part, there are the financial institutions that are willing to take on the risk are probably don't really have the infrastructure in place to deal with these kinds, the due diligence requirements under, Mazin mentioned, the Cole Memorandum, and those financial institutions who do have that infrastructure aren't necessarily willing to take on the risk because they are fearing that under the Obama administration there are some assurances, but that they won't be slapped with money laundering charges or loss of federal deposit insurance, but it's a pretty substantial risk. So we're anticipating over the next 5 to 10 years that we're going to be having issues with handling the cash for the payment here. You may or may not be aware the DEA issued a memo in August of this year that said that they were going to maintain the Schedule I status of the Controlled Substances Act. So they did, however, increase the number of research institutions. So they were kind of caught in a catch-22. They said there wasn't enough research to justify lowering them, but there wasn't enough facilities to allow the research. So they did expand that. We had to deal with, because of the volume of cash, and in fact, I think it ended up being 300 times more than we expected it to be. We had to have substantial security and presence in our department for not only the taxpayer, but also our staff. We have state trooper presence there as well. We have taxpayer scheduled appointments to make deposits because, you know, a $10,000 deposit isn't going to take as long to count as a $100,000 deposit if it's in cash. So we balance the amount of time that we need. We schedule appointments according to how much they're going to bring in. And we have everything has to be done in dual control under DAS guidelines. We can't have the same people that take initially intake the money also be the ones that reconcile it on the back end or have anything to do with the depositing. So there's quite a few of staff there. I think our cost to implement the Early Start program were somewhere around $2.5 million. Most of that was for staff. We did have it very unexpectedly transferred to the Department of Revenue in May of 2015. And so we had just a few months to pull that together and get it in place. We do have it in place, and it's been pretty successful. But we are anticipating that it's going to go 5 to 10 years before we have anything change at the federal level. Even with California coming on board and some of the other states across the country, we just need more votes in Congress. So I don't know what slide this is. If you want to keep going to the revenues, the receipts. There you go. So the first page, I think, has been in OLA's published before in the Marijuana Committee about the receipts. The first, the 2015-16 fiscal year receipts were just almost $21 million. So far this fiscal year, which started July 1 of 2016, the receipts have been almost $34 million. Monthly deposits are remitted net of a 2% administration fee. They can take 2% of the tax for their cost to collect the tax and retain it. That's not uncommon. It's the way it is for the 911 tax program, the state lodging tax program. There's ability for folks to be reimbursed for their costs. Senate Bill 1511, like Mazin said, did add the additional edibles, the non-psychoactive topicals and receptacles, which are commonly referred to as vape pens. Sales for that began on June 2nd of 2016. So that is the last month of the second quarter. So we don't actually have any data yet for whether there was an increase in sales or anything because of these additional products. It's really too early to tell. Once we start processing these returns, we'll be able to do really more the third quarter when we have a full 3 months worth of these kinds of sales. We'll be able to do any kind of analysis. Payments, just a reminder, the receipts aren't really a good proxy for this because we don't know that they've actually the deposits actually are what their tax liability is. That's why it's so important for us to get the tax returns from folks. We have been working with them. And I just want to let you know our research department, the folks that were up here earlier and some other folks have put out a report based on the first quarter returns we have in-house so far. And they actually released it today and I did provide it. It's in OLIS for you to review at your leisure. And we can, of course, talk about it at another time if you'd like. We have been enforcing. We do have some failure to file assessments that have gone out for first quarter and second quarter. We're scheduled to do some failure to file assessments here for the third quarter. We have return compliance of about 85% for first quarter. Again, folks think that making that deposit is enough, and it is not enough. They need to actually file the return to reconcile those three deposits that they've made. Right now, the quarter two, we're at about 75%, quarter three, about 60% compliance. So folks still, they're learning, but we're actively going out and we're we're reaching these guys. We're going to, there's a small number of taxpayers, so we're going to their stores, talking to them if they aren't returning our calls. We're talking to them, explaining the errors that they're making on their returns. We've worked with the OLCC in putting the information into their guidebook as well. We have a dedicated phone line. We have a dedicated website address for these folks to reach out to us. They're starting to become familiar with us. We're starting to become familiar with them. It's just an educational process. We've used listservs to try and reach them and explain their obligations. I think they're really willing to do this stuff. It's just there's just a lot of confusion, a lot of rules for them to, you know, come into this business. The last thing I think I need to talk about is the administration of the local marijuana tax. Our statute that allows us to administer the transit tax program for Lane County and for TriMet was amended to include the DOR ability to administer a local marijuana tax. In this last session, we are working with the League of Oregon Cities and other stakeholders on standardized intergovernmental agreements so that we can do return processing, collection, audit, etc., and have it be as uniform as possible so that those costs are contained. We have a goal of beginning that in January of 2017. So our new core system replacement project, the new system rolled out November 15th, our third rollout out of four, and it included the marijuana tax program. So tax returns are filed online now. Payments are still not made electronically, but the tax return itself can be filed electronically for the retail dispensaries that have the 17% tax with the local tax on it going forward. And again, there's just some reminders about the statutory distributions schedule and then our rulemaking that we've put forward. So the other committee, I think, is very aware of it. Second to last slide, Mazen. That is just a cheat sheet of who to contact for what part of the program, since there's so many agencies involved. All our contact information and all our website information for the four agencies that are primary, four areas that are primary on the tax. So with that, if you have any additional questions.
Is there looking for?
I have a comment.
Yes, please.
I think you're right. We're looking at a new U.S. Attorney General that is an outspoken critic of marijuana, and so I think with regard to the banking part of this, you're absolutely right to look at probably 10 years out before you get some sort of resolution on that. So I don't know what that's going to cost the state over this time period, because what you're describing are added costs that weren't really being anticipated per se, fairly large costs for regarding the banking and you, the Department of Revenue, having to take this money in and figure out how to.
Well, and one point, Mr. Chair and Representative Whitsitt, that I wanted to make too about kind of towards that point is that this doesn't just affect these businesses. This affects the peripheral businesses too, the rental, the landlords. It affects the accountants and the attorneys, and so people are finding that their accounts are being frozen and closed and investigated because they're depositing large amounts of cash. There are specific rules in the Cole Memorandum that allows them to file suspicious activity reports that are not in that state that we don't think that they're in violation of the eight priorities that I think are on Mass. Slide, one of his last slides, about in that are stated in that. So people are saying that their accounts are getting closed and they're bank hopping because they open under other pretenses. So the financial institution doesn't necessarily know that they are this kind of business. So there are a lot of due diligence requirements. They're very expensive accounts to hold when they do open the accounts. But from what we're hearing from them, they're at least anecdotally saying that they're willing to pay that just so they can be bankable.
Mr. Chair, if I may add, having the critical mass of the state of California, and having the whole West Coast looking at California, Oregon, Washington, Alaska, and then Nevada, Idaho, and then that basically adds heft and bulk to the issue. That we probably Oregon by itself or Colorado could not have made it important enough. So that that it says that if there is a solution, the solution will come sooner.
Right. I wanted to get back to the money handling aspects of the department. It sounds to me, based on what you've said, that you're following standard business practices for managing cash transactions.
Mr. Chair.
That allow you to have some confidence that the numbers you're dealing with are accurate and that you're preventing any kind of illegal activity in relation to that cash. Would that be a fair assessment?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, yes, that would be. I can tell you the next time you visit the department, you are on camera from the point in time you enter the building to the point in time you leave the building. The cameras that we have that are over the counting area can zoom in as tight as the denomination of the bills. So we consulted with casinos and we consulted with other financial institutions on how to ensure that the cash is properly handled by staff, and as well as security purposes. We consulted with our state police on placement of cameras and stuff like that. So we're good to go on that. I think that you'd be impressed with what we have going there.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for one more.
This is quick. Dan, thank you, Mr. Chair. How is the redistribution of the revenue to those six categories or so going? And I'm particularly interested in the flow out to the cities and counties. Are you encountering anything difficult there, or is the money flowing smoothly?
Mr. Chair and Representative Helm, there are issues with the distribution of the funds. The way the statutes were written, the Liquor Control Commission can borrow from the liquor fund clear through June 30th of 2017. And we have to pay them back first before any distributions can be made to the liquor fund, as well as I believe there was a loan to the OHA, I think, as well. I don't know why I'm and we have to pay them back first, and then we can make distributions to the local governments. Now, that can't happen until at least they're done spending from the fund, which would be at least July 1 before at the earliest we know. We've made some payments to them already, but we haven't been able to distribute beyond that. So we have distributions scheduled after July 1 and before September 30th by statute for the bulk of it, but there are we're still working through how those distributions will actually be made, because most of them are electronic. We're working with the state treasury, we're working with the state's bank and different stakeholders on how that will happen, but it's not going to happen immediately. It'll happen sometime next summer.
Okay, thank you for that.
All right. Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thank you all very much, and thank you for the enlightening presentation. And with that, there's no other business. See you all next year, or not all, I guess. Sayonara. And with that, the committee is adjourned.